Support for Boston Public Radio comes from the Museum of Science, where you can experience the heart of New England, their new giant screen film showcasing this iconic region. You can see it now on the IMAX Dome screen. Tickets at MOS.org.
Today on BPR Live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library, we know the only certainties in this world are death and taxes. But in Massachusetts, it's death, taxes, and no taxes. That's thanks to what is now a permanent sales tax holiday. We'll take your calls and ask you, is this going to be good for the economy or not if we just shift when we decide to buy that appliance or big screen TV? Then it's reefer sadness. Aww. July 1st has come and gone. So where is our recreational marijuana? Steve Hoffman, chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, joins us to take our questions and yours.
At noon, national security expert Julia Kime is here to go over the latest news coming out of the border. The Trump administration is using DNA testing to match migrant children separated from their parents, saying it's a valid last resort. But is it an ethical one? We ask our medical ethicist, Art Kaplan. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from the Boston Public Library. Jim Browdy, I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Wednesday, from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. I'm starting the show on a very, very sad note. I want to offer this our sympathy to the family of Jenny Phillips, a filmmaker, activist, mother, grandmother, wife of a longtime Boston Globe State House columnist, State House Bureau Chief Frank Phillips, is a regular with us. Died in a swimming accident Monday night in Nantucket.
Did you know her at all?
I'd met her a couple of times over the years. I knew Frank, obviously, a lot better. He's a great reporter, but she had a wonderful, wonderful career doing great work involving prisons and people being abused in prisons. And tell people about the
Hemingway. I don't know if people did know. I mean, it's mentioned in a fine piece in the Globe by Danny McDonald about her death, talking about how when Frank and Jenny went to Cuba in the early 2000s, they were interested in seeing some documents from Ernest Hemingway, and make a long story short, because of her relentlessness, thousands of documents that had not been seen before. Someone characterized it in the story as a CAT scan of Hemingway's brain were available to the public. And then, I didn't even realize this, the digital collection of those documents, again, because of her, was brought to the JFK Library in Dorchester. But those who knew her well, and I know many people who did, raved about her, so we wanted to send our thoughts to Frank and his kids and his grandkids.
And just one note, she was the granddaughter of Maxwell Perkins, a legendary editor, Thomas Wolfe, Hemingway, Fitzgerald, all these other great writers, a great biography written about Maxwell Perkins and how he basically wrote half of these people's novels.
So in any case, to Jenny's family and Frank, who we know well, we're thinking about you. In any case, we know the only certainties in this world, talk about bad timing, are death and taxes, but in Massachusetts, it's death, taxes, and no taxes. That's thanks to what is now a permanent sales tax holiday, which will start in 2019. It was part of that so-called grand bargain, settling all those ballot questions. But now we're just one step closer to having our sales tax holiday, 1 year closer. Yesterday, the House signed off on an amendment that would suspend the state sales tax this August, the weekend of the 11th and 12th. The governor is supportive, and the issue is, what does the Senate do? So for the next few minutes, we're opening up the lines and asking you about the dumbest idea ever in Massachusetts, if these sales tax holidays are worth it, particularly if you can plan your shopping around them and adjust the timing of a purchase. They're designed to stimulate the economy, allegedly good for small business, small retailers, the equivalent of a sugar high by way of our impulse purchases. But where's the impulse, Marjorie, if we know these deals are coming every single year? By the way, all this is a $25 to $30 million feel-good hit on the state's treasury. Our number is 877-301-8970. It totally aggravates me.
You know, I would just like to say, I don't know why this totally aggravates you. We go through this almost every year.
You and I do.
You're
going
to be in your bonnet about the sales tax thing.
Uh-huh.
What is it to you if somebody wants to go up August 11th, mm-hmm. and they want to get a deal on their refrigerator, mm-hmm. or they want to get a deal on their new air conditioner, whatever it is they want to buy, maybe a new stove, mm-hmm. and they just think, you know what, I just saved some bucks. You know, I just saved $400.
I'll tell you what it is.
This is great. Just a feel-good kind of thing, Jim.
Marjorie, you know, what's the last problem? Major appliance?
Especially since, by the way, there are people that claim they have spotted a certain radio and television host, you know, with a refrigerator in this back trunk driving over the New Hampshire border back to Massachusetts.
I will neither confirm nor deny the truth of that. But, Marjorie, let me ask you this question, if I can, before we get to the calls at 877-301-8970. So what's the last major appliance you bought?
Gee, it's been a while. I don't know.
Well, whatever it is. Let's assume you
microwave? That's not a major appliance.
Well, let's say a washing machine. Let's say it's $500. I don't even know what they have. $600. Okay. So you are the only way this works, and it's not just a shifting of timing of your purchase, is if Marjorie Egan opens up the newspaper and she sees a full page ad in the Boston Globe or online somewhere, and it says, washer dryer 6.25% off, which is what the sales tax is.
Yeah.
Raise your right hand and tell me you weren't going to buy that washer, but because you're going to save $30, 6.25%, that you're going to go buy the washer.
You're missing the point.
I'm not missing the point
at all. It's a feel-good thing. It's like when you go
you complain every day. We don't have enough money for the schools in Brockton.
It's one weekend.
Have enough.
It's one weekend.
And it's $30 million. 877-301-8970. Marjorie, let me tell you, I know Marjorie very well.
Okay.
Working together 19 years. She opposes this for one reason, because I'm on the other side. That's all. I mean, she supports the sales tax holiday. Do you remember when Deval Patrick essentially admitted to us on Ask the Governor years and years ago that he knew this thing didn't work? I shouldn't put words. Well, you put words
and
in his own.
And why did he say he didn't oppose it?
Because it's a feel-good kind of.
Exactly. So I'm with the governor.
And you're okay with that, spending $30 million that you could spend for something? You complain about the tea every single day.
I do.
Day.
Complain
think
about
Charlie
pensions
Baker,
all the time, too.
You think Charlie Baker could do something with the $30 million of the tea rather than this phony sales tax holiday?
Yeah, he probably could. And I think that the citizens of Massachusetts, for all they put up with around here, deserve to get a refrigerator with a break.
877-301-8970. I hope everybody, by the way, has paid attention to the fact that I asked Marjorie Egan if she saw an ad in the newspaper online for a 6.25% discount on a product.
Yeah.
Would she buy a product that she would not otherwise do, which is the only reason this makes any sense? She refused to answer
but
the question.
But you know something? I think you might do that.
Zero.
You might just think it might make you feel
6% off? She's making a face. She knows
she's
full of
it. Did you see the picture of the guy coming out of the store with his? I don't even know what store he's at. Best Buy, I think.
Yeah, he had stolen that thing.
He had not stolen it.
Yes, he had.
He had a speaker on his shoulder. He was smiling from ear to ear. He was a very happy man.
Okay, nice try. Let's take some calls. 877-301-8970. And by the way, for those who are waiting to talk to the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, he is going to join us in about 15 minutes or so, and he will be here to answer our questions and yours for a good 30 minutes, so stick around. Mary in Boston, you're first on Boston Public Radio. Hi there.
Hi. Boy, I hate to admit that I agree with Marjorie, but here goes.
I hate it too.
Listen, I know.
Ahead,
nothing
Mary.
Wrong with it, Mary. Well, nothing wrong with it.
Go ahead, Mary.
I know. Last week, do you remember the report in the media that said there was a projected $1.2 billion increase in tax revenue this year?
Yes,
that's right.
I think there's enough, Jim. I don't care if it's only 6%. I don't care what it is. Give it to the little people. You love the little people.
I love the little people on all other days, but not today. So, Mary, tell the truth here, since Marjorie will not answer my question. Would 6.25% off any product that you would not otherwise buy cause you to buy the product to save the 6.25%? Yes or no?
Yes. In fact, I'm going to go online right now and try to find the biggest ticket item that I can afford. Bye.
Nice
good for
try,
you, Mary.
Mary.
Good for you, Mary. And it puts a little lilt in your step. You know what I'm saying?
No, a very little lilt in your step.
Well, a little lilt is better than no lilt.
Marjorie,
at all.
If you saw 20% off, you know what you'd say based on the current environment because of summer sales? You'd say, I'm going to wait till it's 40% off. I'm going to wait till it's 50% off. Nobody buys something they wouldn't otherwise buy to get a 6% discount. Nobody. Nobody.
How do you know?
Because I know human behavior. And as Mary said, I know the little guy, or whatever she said a couple of minutes ago.
Steve from Pepperell. What do you think, Steve?
Hey, Steve. Welcome.
Hi. How you doing?
Excellent.
First time I called. A few years ago, I was looking to buy a snowblower. And when I live up near the border, so I would have bought it up in New Hampshire at Home Depot or something like that. But one of the smaller vendors around here had a sign, sales tax holiday. He had all the snowblowers out there. So I went there, and I supported a local small business. rather than the big company.
There you
so
go.
I think that's worthwhile.
There you go.
Now, Steve.
Great point.
So I agree with Marjorie, I
guess. Thank you,
if
Steve.
If Marjorie were a person of principle, what she would say to you, Steve, is when you go to New Hampshire to buy that snowblower and pay no sales tax, do you know that when you bring it back to use it in Massachusetts, you're supposed to declare on your income tax return or with your income tax return?
I'm sure Steve and others do exactly that.
You're supposed to declare the sales tax. Do you know that that's the law there, Steve?
No, that's too much paperwork.
By the way, the DOR is on their way to your house in Pepperell right now. Thank you for the... Thank you for the call. You know, can I tell you something? Everybody is going to call. Let me anticipate. Everybody's
How many people do you think that go up to New Hampshire to buy liquor and the liquor store is off?
File the thing?
What is it? Is that 95 up there? What route is it, 95?
93.
Is it 93?
Well, it's 95 and
Whatever
93.
Whatever it is. Whatever it is. And they pull over in that in those great big, huge, boxy liquor stores and get all that free sale, no sales tax liquor.
Yeah.
I think they're all declaring on their taxes.
No, but you know what those people are, Marjorie, when they fail to disclose
scuff laws, Jim.
They are felons.
3 to 5.
They're actually not felons. They're mis. Now, let me explain something to you. Every single one of the people who's going to call in this segment are going to say they support the sales tax holiday. And you know what every single one of those people are going to do when there's not enough money for a cop or a firefighter or a teacher in their community? They're going to complain that the state is not spending what it should be spending. So, Marjorie, here's your question. If the choice is between giving, $30 million on a phony sales tax holiday or spending $30 million on the T or on schools in poor, which would you prefer?
That's not how it works out.
Well, that's how
this
it should
is
work
about,
out.
This is about a small break to the taxpayers of Massachusetts.
That achieves just, nothing good.
Yes, it does.
No, it doesn't.
Yes, it does. Jim, you know, you go to CVS, you get the buy one, get one free kind of deal, or you get those reams of coupons for all the stuff you don't want, but on the top of them, one of them says save $6 on the next purchase. Does this matter to the economy? Is it doing anything particular for? No, it's just a fun thing to have.
So you're saying the state should spend $30 million a year on a fun thing to have?
I'm not saying people should spend $30 million a year. I'm just
not
saying...
Not people, the state. The state spends $30 million.
I'm just saying this is a fun event for the people of Massachusetts who feel like they're getting a break. We've got massive taxes here. We've got massive property taxes.
We don't have massive taxes.
Yes, we do.
That is an anachronism.
The property taxes in a lot of Massachusetts are very high. They're very high.
Industrial states, the income tax is comparatively low.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And what do you mean, That's it?
No, I'm just saying you read a lot about corruption in Massachusetts, people ripping you off in Massachusetts.
Do you have one substantive argument? Your only argument
it's all
is
about,
it's a fun thing.
It's all about emotion, Jim. It's all about feel good. It's all about, as you put it, a little lilt in your step.
I didn't say that.
I,
you said
I, for one,
it.
Could use more lilts.
Okay, let's hear what Paul from Worcester has to say. Another ridiculous argument, I'm sure. Hi, Paul. How are you?
Hey, how are you?
Excellent.
Good.
Thanks for calling.
You know I'm a budget guy, and I see people who buy stuff just because it's on sale.
Exactly.
All the time. Absolutely. And I talk to them about it. I mean, I'm trying to help them figure out their budgets, and I say, you know, why'd you buy it? It was on sale. Have you used it? Nope. Have you taken it out of the box? Nope. And then the other thing is that with the amount of sales tax holidays we've had so far. All the major retailers, you know, Bernie and Phil's, Jordan's Furniture, even Home Depot and all them, will sell you anything without sales tax any time of year.
They will?
Look at Bernie and Phil's ads. They say, you know, do you want to get no sales tax, free shipping?
So what does that have to do with the sales tax holiday? What does that have to do with the
sales tax holiday? He said that we could negotiate this on any other day.
I think your point, Paul, is having a sales tax-free item is an attractive thing to people. But the only way this works, since you are a finance kind of guy, the only way this is of any advantage to these businesses and to the state is if it induces people to make a purchase they would otherwise not make. And I would argue that the people you talk to, if you said, here's a 6% discount, most of them would say, forget about it. I'll wait till it's 40% off, because that's the way we're inclined with sales these days. That is true, is it not, Paul?
Well, people will buy stuff because it's on sale. I mean,
not at 6% sale.
Yes, yes. Think about this, Jim.
Yeah.
People who drive SUVs, when the gas price got up to $4 and something, you know, a gallon, they were trading in their SUVs, buying a car that got great mileage for more money than they were saving on gas with that car, so that they could say,
I'm saving money
on gas.
Exactly.
And it was really just an excuse to get a new car.
Absolutely.
Paul, thank you for the call.
But, you know,
Marjorie
has
no idea
what
you're talking
about. Don't
knock buying
things on sale. The buy one, get one free.
I love sales.
Kind of thing. I mean, you know, I have stockpiles of lots of things in my
house.
Okay,
fine.
If you can put them in the basement, you know, eventually you'll
get
to them.
I still have a Flobee. I do. Do you know what a Flobee is?
Yeah, it's a thing where you attach put your hair in the...
With a vacuum cleaner.
With a vacuum cleaner.
And it pulls your hair up and then
you
cut it.
Yeah.
Marjorie, you've now mentioned twice, compared this sales tax holiday to buy one, get one free.
Uh-huh.
I know math is not your strong suit, but let's do this here.
Actually, it's not buy one, get one free. It's usually get buy one, 50% off.
Okay, and 50%, that's exactly my point. Buy one, get one free is a 50% off thing. You just mentioned another 50% off thing. How does that compare with 6%? You continue to avoid the issue. Nobody is moved by getting a 6% savings on any product.
Didn't you just hear Paul?
Yeah,
He was moved. And
he
said
not moved.
Other people he sees are moved, and this is why they have stockpiles of Crest toothpaste and Cetaphil face cleaners in their basement. They often have those face cleaner ones. The ones that are expensive, you know, the Avenos or whatever they are. Yeah. You buy those products and you get 50% off.
Let me ask you something. We've had sales tax holidays. I just realized this from, I think, about a decade and a half off and on with a couple of hiatuses. By the way, do you know the couple of years? You read the Globe story this morning? A couple of years when we didn't do the sales tax holiday, it's because there were state revenue problems. Well, if it turns out this is so good for the economy, the assumption is it would produce additional revenue. So why did they cancel the – why did they not do the sales tax holiday those 2 years, Marjorie?
Dan Inadic is very concerned about his grandfather, his 89-year-old grandfather, who's been known to buy 20 boxes of cereal he doesn't eat because they were 15 cents off a piece, and he's going to love this holiday.
No, that's actually a very productive, good argument. No, there's nothing better – a better argument than saying – his grandfather, who is obviously non-compos mentis based on his description, is buying a ton of things he doesn't need. That's not the point. The point is, can you agree on one thing before...
Arturo says he's been waiting to make a large ticket purchase, and he'll delay until he can buy it without paying that tax.
With,
so there
6%,
you go.
You know this is up to $2,500.
Yeah.
What's 6% of $2,500?
I have no idea.
It's $125,
thank you.
I think it is. $130 or something like that. Look, can you look at me while I'm talking about this? But when you don't look at me, I know it's because you don't have an
argument.
Because
I'm reading the email.
I know. I just want to say, you're telling me that you know somebody, like Arturo, is that his name, who is not making a $2,500 purchase, but is going to make a $2,500 purchase because he thinks he may be able to save $100.
Okay, it's July 10th today, right?
I know what day it
when
is.
When is the sales
it's the
tax
11th,
holiday?
Actually.
When, oh, the 11th.
August 11th or 12th.
August 11th. So
he's going to wait.
Exactly.
Yeah. And he's going to make the purchase that he wouldn't otherwise make to save $100 on $2,500?
No, he's going to wait till August 11th to make that purchase to get a lilt.
Lilt in his step. Let's take one more call because this is really aggravating me. Let's go to Linda and Weston. You're next on Boston Public Radio. Are you going to make it unanimous? Everybody loves the sales tax holiday, apparently. What's up? Linda.
Hi, Jim. Marjorie. I love you guys.
Thanks.
Jim, we met at the Gourmet Chef thing. It's Linda Windows.
Oh, my God. Hi, Linda. How are you? That was fun. We're doing it again this year.
Oh, my gosh.
Okay.
Oh, good. I'll be there.
Okay, great.
Thank you. My blood is boiling. I'm driving, and I had to pull over.
Okay.
I'm against the sales tax holiday. I'm a small business owner, and it affects so many small businesses. They have vacation. People that work for them have vacation, and they have to bring in more people. They have to, you know, pump up their employment. And all those poor people lose money because they have to hire or get people in from vacation.
Okay, Linda, don't go away. I want Marjorie to respond. Now, Linda, I don't know if you heard, is a small business owner.
And I
she's
feel bad
exactly
for
the person who this theoretically benefits. What do you have to say to Linda?
No, I feel bad. I feel bad for Linda. Uh-huh. You raised some very good points. But on the other hand, we've got Dan's grandfather, who's 89 years old. Mm-hmm.
Buying 15 boxes of cereal. Which probably isn't taxed anyway, now that I think about it.
Who's looking forward to this, is a wonderful day. And people are somebody just wrote in and said, this was Jack who wrote in and said, this is the guy that keeps a list of everything you want to ban.
Mm-hmm.
He says, this is not about the government. It's not about helping the government. It's for, and it's not about small businesses, obviously, Linda, because you're getting the shaft there. But it's for one day for the people.
Yeah.
One day for the people.
Hey, Linda, we hope you'll come to the Chef's Gala again this year. It's one of the best events of the year, and Marjorie and I will be there. Linda, thank you for your call. So do you want to sum up? What is your argument again here? Your argument is we should spend $30 million because it's fun. Is that a fair summary of your argument in defense of the sales tax holiday?
Well, you could hope. You know, the state Senate may not go for it, Jim.
Well, can you answer, but before you leave this, that is your primary argument in defense of this. I just want to be clear for next year's
discussion. Here's my primary argument. You know, you feel like you get back to the parking meter and you have like a minute left and you got a ticket.
Yeah.
And your taxes on your house keep going up. Mm-hmm. And you know, you feel as though maybe you're not getting as much as you want to from the public services in your town. You call the cops and they don't
and
come.
And the police captains in Methuen are making $435,000.
That's right. The police captains in Methuen are making $400,000. That's right.
$435,000.
And you feel that this is an opportunity to get a little tiny bit of payback from the man, Jim. It makes you feel good.
I want you to know, I have to say one thing in your defense. Mm-hmm. There's a story online. You missed it now. If the sales tax holiday goes through the Senate, the five captains will give back the $435,000 they're each making in Methuen.
Yeah. If you haven't seen that story, look it up. $435,000 for five police captains.
No, you left out one great part
Methuen.
Of the story.
Methuen.
And one of the five captains is the son of the mayor.
That's right.
Who says he has no idea how this happened.
Nobody has any idea how
it happened.
Salaries got so high. This is why people need a sales tax, Jim. A teeny tiny bit of justice in the Commonwealth.
Go.
Up next, now that recreational marijuana is legal in Massachusetts, why is there no recreational butt shop, cannabis cafe, or job postings for bud tenders to be found? Steve Hoffman, the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, is going to join us up next to explain all this. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan broadcasting live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. July 1st has come and gone, and a lot of people, Marjorie Egan in particular, are wondering, where is the weed? Joining us to explain why Massachusetts has not yet morphed into the Rocky Mountain State and when it will is Steve Hoffman. Steve is the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, and for the next half hour, he will not only be kind enough to take our questions, but yours. And if you want to speak directly to the chairman, it's 877-301-8970. Chairman Hoffman, it's good to see you.
Thank you for having me here.
Thank you so much for being here.
Go ahead.
No, I was going to say, it's always my pleasure to be here with you guys.
Oh,
it's
thank very you nice very you. Much. And you're a nice guy to come in and take our questions and callers' questions as well. So what happened? Why did nothing open on July 1st?
Well, I've answered this question several thousand times, it feels like, over the last couple of weeks. July 1st was never a mandate. There's no date that said the stores had to open on a specific day. We had mandates that said we had to have regulations in place by March 15th, which we did. We had to start accepting applications on April 1st, which we did. There's nothing about July 1st in the legislation. We said all along that we're going to do this right. We're not going to set a deadline, an artificial deadline. We're making progress. Stores will open. But July 1st has come and gone because it wasn't, as I said, an official requirement of the process.
But it was
process.
A goal. I mean, you were explicit in every time we've spoken to you, every time any other media person has spoken to you about it not being a statutory deadline, but it was a goal.
Yes.
And it was a goal that was delayed by 6 months from what the people endorsed on the ballot.
Actually,
when the legislature pushed it back till July.
That's
was
right.
it 8 months?
Well, so the voter initiative, November of 2016, passed. Legislator put it on hold, said we're going to take 6 months. The actual legislation was signed by Governor Baker in July of last year. So there's actually an eight-month delay before. And the commission was appointed September 1st.
So beyond Steve Hoffman, the notion that there was never a statutory obligation, putting that aside, after July 1st, one applicant has been approved in Leicester. Is that not correct?
No, we've now approved four.
Four retail outlets?
One retail outlet.
What's
four, four provisional applications have been approved.
But why weren't things ready to go on July 1st?
Well, the way the process works is that we have some very stringent licensing requirements. There are four packets of information we ask for from each applicant. So the first thing is we have to get that information and make sure it's complete. Once that's complete, three things happen. One is we do our own internal review. Second, we send it out for all the principals for background checks. And the third thing is that we send out a notification to the city or town in which the facility is going to be located. And they have 60 days by law to get back to us and say all of their requirements have have been met. So we have our own process, which we're doing. We just hired another licensing person. So we're not behind on our, you know, review of these licenses, but we are dependent upon third parties, and that's just the way it should work and the way it's legislatively required to work. So,
our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to speak directly to the chair of Cannabis Control Commission.
Yeah, that's Steve Hoffman, who is with us. This is something I didn't know about. I probably should have. Uh-huh. But there's a lot of testing required, this marijuana. And one of the stories I read, it's talking about all the marijuana must be tested from seed to stem or whatever.
Well, there are two different things. Both are important. One is we have a requirement that anything that's sold at retail has been tested by an independent lab. And the testing is pretty extensive. It includes the potency. It includes other chemicals. And so one of the benefits of a legalized industry is that people know exactly what they're getting. And so that's a non-negotiable requirement. Everything sold at retail is tested by a lab. The seed-to-sale tracking system is essentially every plant gets tagged with an RFID tag, and we track it all the way through the process. So not only do we know that it's gone through the lab testing, but we also know that it was grown in-state by a licensed cultivator. We know there's no diversion because every plant, we know where it ends up. So they're both important parts of the process to make sure that everything is tested.
So that would mean like you would go to the place where the marijuana is grown.
Yes.
And then test it there, and then...
Well, what we do is we send our inspectors out, every plant that is over 8 inches tall, every plant that's over 8 inches tall has a unique RFID tag on it, and so our inspectors go out and make sure that what the company is reporting in their inventory actually exists, and there's not less or more than they've reported. And again, part of it is to ensure that it goes through the testing process, but a big issue, and one that the U.S. attorney mentioned yesterday, a big issue is to make sure that there's not overproduction and things don't get into the black market and go out of state. We know every plant where it ends up, so we're pretty confident that we can ensure that that does not happen.
You know what's neat about this, just in terms of people that want to buy marijuana? I mean, we're learning all these new things, or at least I'm learning all these new things.
I didn't know any of this until nine months ago.
That there are certain types of marijuana that are more uppers as opposed to downers or mid-level things.
Things have changed.
Yeah, if you want to go to sleep, if you want something to help you with your insomnia, that's different than something if you want to, like, you know, and I joke about, you know, cleaning the house furiously for 3 hours, you know, because there's the sativa marijuana that's a upper. Very exciting. You'll know this, Jim, when you go to the store.
So I just want to stay on this independent testing lab thing for a second, Steve Hoffman, and then we're going to get to calls at 877-301-8970. When I saw you on TV, which I think
was 2 weeks ago,
the third or something, whatever it was, there were not only were there no independent testing labs, at that date there was not even an application submitted. Yeah. Has one now been
submitted? Yeah, we have one, and I think we will have our public commission meeting tomorrow, and we'll get an update on all the full applications that we received. I believe there's a second that will be announced tomorrow when we do the update statistically.
And they are ready for action.
They're ready to go.
We
have to go through the same licensing process, though, you know, review all their submissions, get background checks, get city and town approval. But, you know, they're operating already, so it shouldn't take very long once they've got that to get going.
So the one retail outlet you've approved, this Lester thing, based on your projection about when the independent testing lab will finish the process, been approved by you, what's your best guess as to at least when that retail outlet will be
available? You know me well enough to know I'm not going to give you
a specific date. What do you think?
But there's two things going on. One is the labs, as you pointed out. The second thing is that what we did is issued provisional licenses with conditions. Mm. And when the applicant tells us those conditions have been met, then we'll go out and inspect. So a lot of it is actually determined by the applicant in terms of how quickly they get back to us and say we're ready to be inspected.
So is Lester potentially an August thing?
It's going to be, you know, a month, 6 weeks, 2 months. I'm not going to be
August
more specific
than
that. Just again, because it is not something that we have completely within our control.
But likely August or September, unless there's some roadblock. Am I asking you or am I asking her?
Where's Lester?
It's in Worcester County, I believe.
Okay.
I was born in New York City, but I was raised in outside of Boston. I have learned so much more about this state in the last 8 months. I've been every square inch of the state over the last 10 months or so.
I have one last thing, too. Before we get to the calls, you mentioned the U.S. attorney. I think it was it was a big story, I think, in today's Globe.
He came out with
Andrew
something Lella. Yesterday.
Did you ever have an opportunity to meet with him?
No. We reached out. And we did not.
So this is a unit. Could you explain to people in English as best you can? Everybody knows that Jeff Sessions has said we're going to enforce the laws.
Right.
The Attorney General of the United States. We're not. If the voters of a state like your state say you legalize marijuana, it doesn't matter to us. It's illegal under federal law. Mm-hmm. Banks, you're at risk. We'll get to banks in a few minutes.
I figured we would.
So what did Lelling say, and what's the impact of what he said? That's a U.S. attorney.
So I thought it was a good thing. So, first of all, appreciate that he provided some clarity about his office and the intentions mm-hmm. of his office. I think clarity is a good thing. What he essentially said is that he's not going to say, I won't enforce federal law. But he said, here are the things I'm concerned about. And he raised three issues. One I already talked about, which was diversion, which is, overproduction ending up in the black market and crossing state lines. Second thing was underage usage, people under mm-hmm. 21. And the third was criminal elements involved in the industry. And a couple things. One is all those things were in the Cole Memorandum, which Attorney General Sessions rescinded in January. But we built our regulations consistent with the Cole Memorandum. So we are very comfortable that we have strong regulations, which we will enforce, about avoiding diversion, about preventing underage usage, about preventing criminal elements in. So what he did, in my opinion, is he just essentially restated the core parts of the Cole Memorandum, which we had already, as I said, taken as like guideposts. So I thought it was all good.
So it's not a formal assurance as such,
no.
And he went out of his way
He can't.
Is his statement enough to cause, I assume most people know that no bank has signed up to process
not for recreational.
Credit cards now for recreational. Century Bank, which we have a long history with in our former lives at commercial radio, was the only bank, I think, that was doing medical
That's
marijuana.
Correct.
Will this open that up a little bit?
Yeah, it's up, obviously up to the banks to determine. I think it does. I think it makes, as I said, clarity is good.
Have you gotten any positive feedback since Lelling spoke from banks?
Oh, no, I haven't heard anything since yesterday. I've seen what other people have said in terms of responding to press inquiries.
Is anything in the works, on your estimation, prior to yesterday on the bank front?
A lot of things are in work in terms of conversations with both individual banks and with their associations, and same with credit unions. So, I feel like we're making progress on that, and I think, as I said, clarity is a good thing. So hopefully in their decision-making process, the clarity that U.S. Attorney Lelling provided yesterday is a good thing.
One last thing on this. Marjorie asked me this question, and I pride myself on knowing a decent amount about this, not nearly as much as you, obviously. Until banks sign up,
yes,
it's a cash-only business.
Yeah,
you can explain what most likely means
in
a minute. So when a retail outlet opens up and takes in $32,000 mm-hmm. today, mm-hmm. what, do they stick it under their mattress when they go home?
I can't comment on
isn't
that.
That's crazy?
Essentially what they
I'm concerned about this, and I've made it clear I'm concerned about this. Other states that have preceded us, it is a cash-only business, although, as I've mentioned, I think, on your show previously, 4 years after the fact, in Colorado now, about 80% of the industry is banked, at least from a cash management standpoint, but it took a while for people to get comfortable with the regulations and how well they're enforced. I'm trying to accelerate that time frame for Massachusetts. When I said probably. There are some non-bank solutions, what are called closed-loop networks.
What does that mean?
They essentially process credit card transactions without using the banks. And so it's a private thing. It has to be licensed by the state, but I've had four or five of those companies approach me, and I said, well, it's not my decision. You need to talk to the Commissioner of Banking to see if you can get licensed by the state.
How's that going?
I don't know. I've helped them get meetings. I don't know where they're going to end up, but that's worked in other states, and so that's a way to probably bridge. This is going to get solved, and banks will participate mm-hmm. in this industry. It's just a question of what we do in the interim.
I'll wait for my other questions so we can get to the calls, but just one thing on the banks before we leave.
Sure.
So if you are a marijuana proprietor, you got to find somewhere to put that $32,000 in cash. And I thought, what do you buy a huge vault in some location?
What are you going to do when you get your license, Marjorie? How are you going to handle it?
She was hoping
I don't
you'd say
I was
that.
Hoping you'd straighten me out.
877.
When you apply, I have to recuse myself.
Exactly. 301-8970. Heather in Burlington, you've been very patient. You're on the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, Steve Hoffman. Hi, Heather.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I have a question about the independent testing lab.
Sure.
The fact that it's taken so long to get an independent lab makes me wonder, and I'm not familiar with it, is the medical marijuana that's that's being sold being tested today?
That's a good question.
Yes, it is. And the labs that are applying are servicing the medical marijuana industry currently. So in our regulations, we are required to have no less stringent testing requirements than medical marijuana. So it's going to be the same facilities, at least initially.
Heather, thanks for your call. We appreciate it.
You know, we were just talking about the sales tax holiday, and Jim was saying it was a terrible thing. Paul wants to know if the sales tax holiday, considering that the Leicester store may be open in August, will that apply to pot sales?
You know, it's way outside of my field of expertise. You know, there's a 20% tax on retail marijuana sales. 3% is a local city and town tax, so that's, I think, totally outside of the... 10.75% is an excise tax that funds the commission and some research that we're required to do. And then there's a 6.25% state sales tax. So, again, I'm not an expert, but I would assume it would be treated the same way as other sales.
Actually, I don't think that's right. If someone can check the story on the sales tax that we were doing a few minutes ago, one of our co-workers, I think that it said that marijuana was exempted from the sales tax holiday.
I think you're right. Again, this is a Department of Revenue's issue, not mine, but I think you're right.
That is outrageous.
Let's go back to the calls. Billy and Stoughton, you're on with Steve Hoffman, Chair of the Commission. Hi.
Hi, everyone. You know, we've come a long way in this country getting rid of cigarette smoking. You know, and I was a victim of secondhand smoke when I was younger. I was always sick. I always had lung problems. Mm. And now... we're allowing marijuana to be legal in this country. In this, there's a lot of people in federal prison who are dealing 1,000 pounds, 1,500 pounds, selling it, and they're doing 10 to 15, 20 years. How do we rectify those sentences when all of a sudden the next day it's legal in Massachusetts? Yeah. I don't know. I don't think there's ever been a discussion about, you know, the people in federal prison who are just dealing it, you know, amongst their friends for 1,000 pounds, which is basically 16,000 ounces. I don't think it's a big deal to have 16,000 ounces that's legal now.
So,
what do you guys think?
Thank you.
Well, the commissioner, we'll find out what he thinks, the chair.
Well, part of that is legislative, you know, in terms of, you know, existing sentences. What we are doing, though, is we are trying to give back to people that have been harmed by the imposition of previous drug laws. And so in our regulations are incentives for people that have marijuana offenses to help them participate in the new industry and to give them, in some respects, some incentives. So we're trying, you know, we can't get people out of jail. That's the legislature's job. But for those that have served time for these offenses, we're trying to help them participate in this new industry and try to give back a little bit.
Thanks for calling.
We're talking to Steve Hoffman from the Cannabis Control Commission. You know, one thing I wanted to be clear about, because I've gotten different answers from this, and I've read a story this morning that had yet another answer. I was concerned that there's, I think 40 towns have a ban, 160 is a moratorium.
It's a little more than 40,
And there's 160 with a moratorium. That's 351 cities and towns in Massachusetts.
Right.
So a big chunk of them have said we're not participating, at least not right now.
Right.
Are they or are they not sharing in the sales tax that goes into the general fund?
Yeah, so they clearly would not get the 3% sales tax that the local cities and towns are allowed to collect. But you know, the 6.25% goes into the general fund, and I am not privy to how that general fund gets allocated across the cities and towns.
You know why it bothers me so much? Because you have towns like Leicester or Boston where Mayor Walsh has said he's fine with them, or other towns have said it's fine. You know, a lot of towns, it's not in my backyard. They voted for marijuana, and yet they're not going to allow any marijuana stores. It seems not quite fair that they join in that largesse. And your buddy over there at Mass, at the Mass Municipal Association.
My former coworker, Jeff Beckwith.
Yeah, I thought he said that wasn't Municipal. Going to happen. But
that's totally outside of the purview of the commission. I don't know what happens to general funds. I do want to, though, if I could just jump in. There are 40-plus cities and towns that have banned. There are 130 plus or minus that have moratoria. Those moratoria have finite time frames, and I'm taking it at face value that they're planning tools. So we promulgated our regulations. They're going through their planning process. I suspect that most of those towns are sincere, that they're planning tools. They're not trying to stop or delay.
Okay.
And we'll see. As they expire, we'll see what happens.
By the way, the sales tax holiday does not apply.
Yeah, that's right.
You know, speaking of local communities, you and I had this discussion on television a week ago. What?
You should be fighting against that since you're the big sales tax holiday guy.
I heard the previous debate. I'm not getting into that.
You'll get into it in a few minutes. You know, Chairman Hoffman here, this whole city and town thing. See, let me step back. And we did have this discussion. We lived through the medical marijuana debacle. I know that's my word, not yours.
Correct.
You were not the chair of anything at that stage, where the people voted overwhelmingly, and a year plus later, it was a disaster. The law was not being complied with. It's finally, according to the governor on our show, they finally have the requirement in every county or whatever the requirement is under the statute.
Right.
And then we have the Attorney General of the Commonwealth saying, Maura Healey, and we'll ask her this when she joins us next, saying not too long ago that any delay beyond December 31st for these towns involved in these moratoria is, quote, longer than reasonably necessary and possibly unconstitutional, until it wasn't possibly unconstitutional when she said a week or so. Was it Marshfield? Hey, whatever.
Mansfield.
Mansfield, all the same. But at Mansfield,
I don't know if they'd agree with that.
I'm only kidding. Said, we'll give them another 6 months.
Right.
Why should the public not be cynical when time and again there's a delay, particularly after she has said it may have been unconstitutional to have this kind of delay?
She was very clear after the fact, because there was some pushback on that. She was very clear that Mansfield should not be considered to be a precedent. So I'm going to take her at face value and say, you know, she is going to maintain a finite time frame. Most of the moratorium that are currently in place will end by the end of the year, and we'll get
on
with
things. Are you okay with that extension for
You know, it's a unique circumstance. It is the decision of the Attorney General's, not the Commission, so I'm not going to comment on that.
Okay, which means you're not happy with it. Is that
No, you're putting words into my mouth, as you usually do.
Okay, thank you. Let's go to Ken on his cell. You're on with Steve Hoffman, the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission. Thanks for the call, Ken. Hi.
Ken. Yeah, hi, Steve.
Hi.
First of all, I want to be respectful, but it is difficult because I'm a retired state employee, so I'm pretty well aware of bureaucracies and government double talk. I find it interesting that after all these years of making criminals out of people, now the government, state of Massachusetts in this part, wants to be the new pusher. Of course, they're not going to jail. And secondly, if you
excuse me, can I interrupt you, Ken, if I may? The government didn't decide anything. The people decided in November of a year ago that they wanted a legal.
It was 53-47.
Okay.
Are you going to give her some math lessons?
That they wanted to legalize.
Okay.
So it was people like it was your fellow citizens, not the government. But go ahead, Ken.
Don't have to interrupt as much. I just want to listen to my comment and then comment on mine.
Sure.
What I am saying is it becomes a government debacle, maybe what we should have done is just not arrest people and let people grow their own, and rather than legalizing it, decriminalize it. That would solve all of the problems. And I understand it was voted on by the people. However, the government should have been involved in it to begin with. People are growing up. They want to take a puff. They want to do this. They want to do that. They should stay out of it.
Let's get the response from Steve Hoffman. Ken, thanks for your call.
I guess a couple things. One is it is decriminalized. It was, I think, 2014, if I'm correct, it was decriminalized. So that's already happened. Two is, you know, our job is to enforce the law and to build regulations to make law happen. If you don't like the law, it's a legislative issue, and I encourage you to speak with your representative. But we're just implementing the law that was passed by the legislature and signed by the governor.
Okay, that is the voice of Steve Hoffman, the chairman of the Cannabis Control Commission. He's with us for up until the top of the hour. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, and we are broadcasting live from our studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan. If you're just tuning in, Steve Hoffman, chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, is kind enough to be with us to take our questions and yours. Lines are full, but when someone hangs up, you can call 877-301-8970. When you read the piece in the Globe a couple of days ago, did you learn new names for marijuana? Are you using? You didn't read the story?
I did. But
shoes, shrimp. Yeah. Yeah. Mowing the lawn. I can't see you saying mowing the lawn, Steve.
I won't say that I'm an aficionado.
Okay, that's fine.
You know, this kind of story is going to happen a lot, I anticipate, with more and more people. I assume more and more people might try marijuana. We haven't tried it for a long time. But the woman is named Berta Dent Coughlin. I guess she was on your show, Jim.
Same night that Steve Hoffman
was
on.
I met her backstage.
That she, after she got hurt, she fell at work. She underwent a drug test, and the test came back positive for marijuana use. She admitted that she'd used a vape pen during the previous long weekend, and she lost her job. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if this is in your jurisdiction either, but this is going to happen to people.
Yeah, it's an issue. It is unfortunately not in our jurisdiction. So first of all, I feel badly for her. I hope things work out. But it is the law that employers can impose whatever drug policies they want to. That's not something the commission. I hate to sound like a bureaucrat, but the commission has very specific responsibilities, which is that we can regulate and enforce our regulations for licensed enterprises, whether they're cultivators or retail stores or labs. Anybody that's not licensed by the commission, we have no enforcement authority over. And so employers, as I said, by state law, can impose whatever drug testing they want.
But you know what's weird about this, obviously, is that, like, liquor, you know, goes out through your system really quickly. Cocaine, a lot of drugs go through your system really quickly. Marijuana does not.
Well, that's one of the reasons why there's a challenge in terms of DUI, and testing for DUI, because it does stay in your system for quite a while.
Yeah. So the anticipated people that may be drug tested, I didn't know that as many people drug testers do drug test. Quite a few people apparently drug test.
I don't know how many employers actually do
so
that.
Yeah, so we'll see what happens with Bernadette Coughlin.
Yeah, I wish her luck.
So do we. Robert in Cambridge, you are next on Boston Public Radio with the commissioner of the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission. Hi, Robert.
Hi, everybody.
Morning.
My question is directed to Mr. Hoffman.
Sure.
As a taxpayer in the Commonwealth here, I'd like to know what qualifications you bring with you to have the job that you have.
That's a fair question.
That's certainly a fair question. I guess, first of all, I would suggest that you ask the treasurer who appointed me what made her think I was qualified. The way the legislation was written and the commission was created, there were five commissioners. Each of us had to have a different background. The background that I was chosen against was a background of being in business and particularly having experience with startups, because in reality what we're doing, I think, is just a gigantic startup. It happens to be a startup in state government rather than the private sector, but it has a lot of things in common, including starting off with no money, no staff, and a lot of work to do in a very short period of time. And I am very experienced in that. So again, you should ask the treasurer who appointed me why she thought I was qualified, but those are the specific requirements in the legislation, and I do think I meet them.
Robert, thank you for your question. We appreciate it. Oops, sorry. Go ahead.
One more thing.
Sure.
Mr. Hoffman, how well do you know the treasurer that appointed you?
I went to high school with her, graduated in the class of 1971 from Brookline High School. I knew her then. I saw her once in the 40-plus years since we graduated, which was at our 40th reunion, and I had spoke to her with my wife for about 5 minutes. So I know her, but not well, and certainly not for a long, long time.
It's another good question, though, Robert. Thank you for calling the show.
Robert's suspicious, obviously.
Here's my response to that, if you give me a second, which is if all it took was going to school with somebody to get a job, I should be a senior executive with the New England Patriots because Bill Belichick and I are college classmates.
That is not true.
Oh,
that is absolutely
you went to
true.
Wesleyan? Wesleyan?
Class of 1975, Wesleyan economics majors.
Really?
Yeah, but I don't have a job with the Patriots, I checked.
Did you ever chum up with him at Wesleyan?
No, we hung in different social circles.
You did.
Let me put it that way.
But
I knew him.
Okay.
Was he quite as wild and crazy then as he is now?
I'll tell you what.
I
don't know what he's like now, but he actually is a pretty funny guy.
That's what people say.
Back in the early 70s, he had a great sense of humor. I can't speak to what he's like today.
Did you wear hoodies around campus then?
I don't recall.
Okay.
That was not standard garb. We were more tie-dyes and T-shirts
exactly.
back in those days.
Steve Hoffman, before we get back to the calls, I know you don't want... I'm not asking you for a specific date, but let's come close. What does the fall look like in your estimate, based upon what you know, applications that are in the pipeline?
Sure.
Obviously, you know what stage
exactly.
they are.
Exactly. Christmas is coming. We're thinking about our gift list.
What are we likely to see? We're not going to hold you to this.
No, I think the fall is going to look like two things. One is I think you'll see retail stores opening.
Opening.
And two is I think you'll see at our public commission meetings where we review the recommendations for staff from staff on the completed applications, you're going to see a pretty heavy flow of applications coming in as people get up to speed and are getting their applications in. So I think you'll see continued evolution. I don't know what the curve is going to look like, but it's going to be steady and upward trending.
You know, a lot of people are concerned about the smelliness of marijuana and the secondhand smoke thing about marijuana. I read this morning that these vape pens that you are more like electronic cigarettes, and so the smell is not as significant and the smoke is not as significant. Yeah. So is that something that could placate people that are worried about that?
I guess, again, that's something that we're, that is a legal product to be sold in terms of what consumer preferences are going to be. That's going to happen, you know, in a free market. So I don't know, but it is something that is legal to be sold.
It does sound like it's much more appealing than just, you know, smoking a joint.
Deb in Arlington, you're next with the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, Steve Hoffman. Hi, Deb.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. First-time caller.
Oh, thank you for doing that. What's up?
So my question is, since we already have medical marijuana in many places, why is it so, why do the retailer, people who are medical marijuana sellers who want to become retailers, why do they have to go through the whole process of application and also all that testing all over again?
Well, the testing is obviously, you know, everything that's sold has to be tested. So, you know, we're not going to retest products that have already been tested, but everything that's going to be sold at a retail store has to be tested. You know, right now where we're at is that there are two separate state agencies involved. So the Department of Public Health has been responsible for regulating medical marijuana since it was legalized in 2012. The job of the Cannabis Control Commission is to regulate the adult use market. In the legislation, by December 31st of this year, we take responsibility for medical marijuana from the Department of Public Health. So once everything is under one regulatory body, I think a lot of the inconsistencies and a lot of what seem like their inefficiencies will get reconciled. But right now, there are two separate agencies responsible for each side of the business, and we each have to do what we're chartered by law to do.
We only have a minute left. We have a lot of phone calls. We have a ton of emails. If someone has a question, and they is there a public information person who attempts to answer these things?
Yeah, so we have a constituent services director. They're accessible for from our website, which is masscannabiscontrol.com.
Masscannabiscontrol.com.
And so we have a constituent services director. We also have a government affairs director who can deal with issues that come up from cities and towns. So we're trying to be incredibly responsive. You know, my email address is on the website, as are the other commissioners, and we respond.
Now, even though you have to recuse yourself on Marjorie's application, can you testify? You can't even write a letter in her support. Nothing is that.
I'm afraid my hands are tied on this one.
Yeah, I'm just glad that the hysteria about marijuana has subsided because we were hysterical for decades.
It's got a ways to go, in my opinion. There's still a stigma on the subject,
so?
And I don't think you can legislate or regulate a stigma. I think what has to happen is over time, people are going to see this looks like any other industry. It's well regulated, it's safe, it's helping public welfare and public health. That's going to take time. But I'm certain that's going to happen.
Steve, we really appreciate
it. Thank you very much for
coming
in and taking calls, Steve. We do appreciate it. Steve Hoffman is chairman of the Cannabis Control Commission. Up next, he already was here. He's not coming up next because Juliet Kime is coming up next. Anyway, thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Is that
the Tom Rush that's going to be on later?
Yes.
On?
Tom Rush?
Oh, yes.
Wow. I might have
We're
to hang out.
He's going to be here at 1:15, and he's singing.
He's going to sing.
He's going to sing the Circle Game?
Or maybe I don't know. But he's
By the way, do you know that Joni Mitchell wrote that for him? He's got a great story.
I did not know who wrote that song.
No one ever heard of Joni Mitchell.
And he's going to be performing this weekend in Natick, too.
He is.
Oh, really?
Yes.
TECAN, one of the great venues. We'll talk about that when Tom gets here at 1:15.
Okay, up next, Steve Hoffman is leaving. Juliet Kime is coming in for a roundup on the news coming out of the border crisis and a lot of other stuff. You're listening to 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, broadcasting live from our studio at the Boston Public Library.
At noon on Boston Public Radio, is the NATO summit going to be the G7 all over again, with Trump bashing allies and boosting Putin and maybe blowing up the Western military alliance along the way? National security expert Juliet Kime joins us for that and more. Boston Globe's Maria Kramer tweeted a stark reality about our broken healthcare system, with a story of an injured woman who begged bystanders who came to her rescue to not call an ambulance because she could not afford it. Medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins us for this and other medical headlines.
Jared Bowen joins us for a rundown of the latest arts and culture events. Tom Rush drops by to perform some tracks off his latest album. And we wrap things up with writer Catlin Moran. Her latest novel, which in the Me Too era, champions healthy female sexuality. That and more is next on Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
Denise Dombrowski. I am Marjorie Egan. You are listening to Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. It is Wednesday. We are broadcasting live, as we do every Wednesday, from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
You seem particularly upbeat. Is that because the commissioner, the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission, said we should have pot shots open in the fall? Is that...
You know, he wants to paint
upbeat
me...
Upbeat may be
he
the
wants
wrong.
To be, paint me as a total
stoner. The chair of the commission made jokes about you filing an application for a license.
Well, you know, let me point something out here.
Please.
I've been crusading for the legalization of marijuana for
you
many
are
years
consistent.
Now. This you is a crusade that I have won, Jim. Which crusade have you won?
So, as I was saying, President Trump has never come across as being a man of the people unless apparently that people is Putin.
I'm meeting with President Putin next week. They're going, will President Trump... Be prepared. You know, President Putin is KGB and this and that. You know what? Putin's fine. He's fine. We're all fine with people.
That is President Trump at a rally he did the other day in Montana. He was previewing his trip to Europe this week. He's there now, where he seems poised to align himself with Russia and agitate our NATO allies.
Ultimately, Germany will have almost 70% of their country controlled by Russia with natural gas. So you tell me, is that appropriate? I mean, I've been complaining about this from the time I got in. It should have never been allowed to have happened. But Germany is totally controlled by Russia.
Germany is totally controlled by Russia, the president said. Joining us for a take on what the fallout from this trip could be, the latest on the immigration border situation, other national security headlines, Juliette Kayyem. Juliette's on the faculty at the Kennedy School, a CNN analyst and a CEO of Zemcar. Hello, Juliette Kayyem.
Hello, both of you. Nice to see you both.
Nice to see you.
Nice to see you too, Juliette. So I was watching this morning on television the scene at the NATO meeting where the president was being very tough on Germany. And John Kelly looked like he was going to, you know, he just looked so upset.
Yeah.
And some of the commentators were saying that I don't know if this is over exaggeration, that this was a very sad day for this peacekeeping alliance post-World War II for NATO, and I don't know what to make of this.
Yeah, so Marjorie is describing the sort of, I don't know, how President Trump sort of took what's just a generic meet-and-greet breakfast, a photo shoot, everyone smiles, it's not that hard. He's sitting next to Pompeo and the NATO ambassador.
Pompeo looked upset, too.
Yeah,
and Kay Bailey Hutchinson. They all looked appalled.
They all look like they wanted to eat their eyeballs, just to be quite honest. And
they did.
But yet they don't say anything, because that is consistent. And Mattis, nowhere to be seen, which is very interesting, given that NATO is actually a military alliance. Mattis is maybe having side meetings that actually get to the core of it. I think NATO will survive Donald Trump. Donald Trump is doing the only thing he knows how to do, which is destroy rather than build. And so he's wrongfully accusing Germany of being in the pocket of Russia. 80% of German oil is not from Russia. It's something like 4% or maybe 10%. He does this thing of projection, right? Lock her up, and then he's the one who's actually under investigation. It's the same thing with Germany. He's just projecting what he knows everyone is saying about him onto Germany. He's now moved this idea that the countries would agree to 2% military spending or support for NATO at 2%. He's now moved the line to 4% to be able to give himself a viable argument for why they all are bad. The consequence of what Trump is doing is, of course, more significant for how long it will be to pick up the pieces after this nightmare is over. I mean, now that's all this is now, you know. It's just one horrible piece of news after another. And this is what Trump does. But there's still adults in the room, including our European allies in Canada and other countries, and our president aligns more with Putin than with any of them.
You know, I don't know if it's another side to the story, right, but another spin to the story, for lack of a better expression. I think a fair-minded person would say exactly what you did. How can we be calling Putin fine when we're trashing Justin Trudeau one week at the G7 and then Angela Merkel at the opening of this NATO thing? But the flip side, I was saying to Marjorie this morning, well, he's not the first president, obviously, who said the other countries have to pay their fair share.
Yeah. And he's right.
I think he's
right about
beyond
that.
Being right. Whether I think politically it is brilliant. I think the louder he screams about this thing while we're sitting here saying, well, technically they're paying X percent, but you're not counting whatever. I can see a person who is not a big Trump supporter, but maybe an independent, maybe on the fence saying, you know, we are getting our butt handed to us. It is not fair. That guy's standing up making sure the United States of America and its taxpayers are treated fairly. Do you, as someone who deals with a lot of foreign policy stuff, much more obviously than we do you not see the appeal of that much higher profile argument that's been made by his predecessors, but in a much more wild sort of way?
Right, the sort of I'm willing to walk away. Right, I think there is, and I think the argument for what NATO does well is really complicated, right? Mm-hmm. That, you know, all the European countries let us have military bases there, and, you know, they do this and we do that. It's a complicated argument. So his simplicity, like the wall, will work on a certain base, you know, at this stage that his base finds it appealing, or, you know, I think independence.
It's not just his base.
I think the destruction of the post-World War II order, I don't know how appealing that is for an independent voter, right? I mean, in other words, an independent voter tends not to support war any more than the rest of us. But the attempted destruction.
Well, it becomes unappealing when there are consequences. I mean, one of the things.
Well, the consequence, I think then the counter argument is, or I think the counter narrative, which is easy to make, is guess who wins?
Meaning Putin. Yeah.
I mean, that's build the wall, that is simplistic. And, you know, our counter has to be it's Putin's world now.
Well, you know,
and including the Oval Office. Yeah, it just is.
And I know this is not the first time it's said it. Forget voters, but who are the elected officials who have seen Putin as the Antichrist forever, who are sitting silently by as the president of their same party?
How the party that almost got us into World War III over, you know, during the Reagan era, only to achieve success, you know, basically pushing the envelope so much that Russia had to fold, how that party became this party is, you know, the story of Donald Trump. I also think there's a certain element of which I'm not the first to say it, a certain element of white centrism that Putin is very Putin also appeals to in his country. In other words, when Putin started to turn towards sort of anti-ethnic, anti-immigrant, anti-diversity, anti-LGBT, that's very appealing to a certain base here, including all those Republican senators. Those Republican senators who sat with Putin, they all have a similar orientation about the way they wish America looked. And
you mean ones who went there for July 4th?
Yes, and who pretended like they weren't there because they had videos saying, Happy July 4th. You're like, but I will say, what we're seeing, and I don't know how this, as I've often said, I don't know how this ends, but, you know, with the appointment of Kavanaugh and or if he gets through, something like 80% of the U.S. population by 2050 is going to live in, you know, I'm just making this up, in 10 states. Right. And yet the minority, which will be older, white and male, will have inordinate political power over that majority. And I think we're seeing a tectonic shift because it won't be acceptable. It cannot be acceptable that a country like ours will have a political leadership that is not represented by the popular vote. I really think that let's say we have four more elections in which Democrats win the popular vote, and a Republican wins the Electoral College. I just don't know how our democracy sustains that.
Here's the actual. You're pretty close. From the Washington Post, one of our coworkers just gave us this. By 2040, about 70% of Americans are expected to live in the 15 largest states. Yeah. They will have only 30 senators representing them, while the remaining 30% of Americans will have 70 senators representing them. That's a really interesting number.
Yeah, and look, I mean, democracies, thank you, team. Democracies reform, they pivot, they change, and if we want to remain one, we will have to do so. But it just seems, let's just put it, it's not sustainable, for example, if the Supreme Court rules on Roe v. Wade and abolishes Roe v. Wade or gay marriage. How is having that That seems unsustainable to me in a democracy, yeah. given the shifts in
and
who
yet,
we are as
and
a
yet,
nation.
And yet, Juliet, the Republican Party's positions are opposed to what most Americans think right now
yeah.
on almost everything,
yeah.
from guns to climate give. Change to right. to abortion to almost everything,
yeah.
and they are the party in power. So,
yeah.
Anyway, let's talk about, this seems a little over the top to me. The U.S. Embassy is warning Americans in London to keep a low profile during Trump's visit. Are the hostile crowds
yeah.
going to turn on American tourists?
And the blimp?
Yeah.
The blimp that the London mayor could not reject. The big blimp of Trump hanging over it. Yeah,
The diaper.
Right,
Trump,
and they're also
yeah.
expecting, if you go to London now, you will be warned as a visitor that they're expecting mass rallies in 20 cities and stuff against
yeah.
Trump. I mean, the president is wildly unpopular, not just here. I mean, if you look at his polling, his approval ratings have not gone up. They've gone down, and his disapproval has gone up. So wildly unpopular president both here and abroad. So I think it is absolutely correct. You know, obviously, Americans are good representatives of a very different kind of nation than the one people see on TV, represented by our president and the White House
yeah.
and pedophile, not you know, and sexual abusers. His new communications director is a guy who hid sexual abuse for 10 years at Fox News. You know,
probably longer than that.
Yeah, but it's a you know. So we are good representatives of a country that many of us view as very different than what you're seeing on TV. On the other hand, you know, if you're going to wear a MAGA hat, that's not very popular in downtown London right now. And so be warned.
We're talking to Juliet Kayyem. When Donald Trump was on the White House lawn before he left
yeah.
for Europe, he was asked about the family separation crisis. We're going to talk about one aspect of it for a minute. And he said he actually had a solution to it. Here's what he had to say.
I don't think...
Well, I have a solution. Tell people not to come to our country illegally. That's the solution. Don't come to our country illegally. Come like other people do. Come legally.
You know, there's so many aspects. We're going to talk to Art Kaplan a little bit later about these DNA tests
yeah.
that allegedly suggested there was not a connection and what the ethical issues are there. There are also some really serious consequences for some pregnant women.
Mm-hmm.
who have been detained without medical care. Fill us in a little bit on that, if you can.
So a lot of stories emanating from of course, the family separation issue, which has gotten the most play, which is essentially, what are these detention facilities like? There was a report this week about what those detention facilities are like for pregnant women, and they are grim. And women are losing their children, that they are miscarrying because of either the lack of medical care or the absence of just basic health needs or you know, the delivering of basic health needs. And so there are, a bunch of plaintiffs and women who are talking about their experience in ICE detention because ICE has now, you know, is now detaining all sorts of people under tremendously stressful, horrible conditions in ways that ICE was never intended to do because we used to have catch and release. We have it again, as was announced last night.
Which is a real important point. Catch and release is the program that President Trump railed against nonstop.
Right.
It
and
was
let
the
me
Obama
just be clear.
Program because you couldn't keep people in these detention facilities for
right.
longer, et cetera. So it's like we're back to right where we were.
Except for not being able to find 3,000
exactly.
Family members of these children and women losing their babies in custody.
And
let's just be clear here. Everything that has been done in the last 3 months was completely known. I mean, the consequences of everything done over the last 3 months by having this 100% prosecution rate and ending catch and release was 100% knowable by everyone, right? That you would have too many detainees, that you would have to separate kids, that you were under a court order that did not allow kids to be in custody for too long, that pregnant women's needs would not be taken care of, and that you would eventually have to reunify them. All of it was knowable. And yet, here we are, right? And just to pick up, you quoted the president. It is actually not true that all of them are coming here unlawfully. Some are actually coming here as lawful asylum seekers
right.
and this is their way of doing it. But, you know, I mean, who cares, right? Even if they came here unlawfully at this stage, I mean, this is just madness.
By the way,
now,
you know, we should point out one just quick thing, that you can bleed to death from miscarrying.
Yeah, of course.
It's a very dangerous. It can be very dangerous. So that was a woman talked about. She was just bleeding and bleeding and bleeding.
And knew she was miscarrying because
she couldn't get help.
Right.
You know, can we talk about stay on reunification just for a second? Beyond the fact that the that obviously the administration is not complying with a court order. And beyond the fact that when they said there were 500 unifications a week or so ago, that was obviously untrue, they've deported some of the parents.
Yeah.
Even if there is the best of intentions, which some people like Elizabeth Warren the other night with me questioned, and she's not alone in that regard, and she's been on the southern border, how do you reunite a young child with a mother who's been deported from the United States?
And let me put an even worse caveat on that. Chances are she was deported to a nation that she was trying to leave because she was under threat of death. So do we even know that she's still alive or that he's the father?
But the reality
still alive?
Is those are not going to happen.
How do you – well, I mean, one possibility is – and this is why the lack of leadership or centralization of the reunification process is mind-boggling, because there's a State Department aspect to it, that the countries where these women reside do try to represent them with the State Department here to figure out where the kids are. But this is not for lack. This is literally now just – this is an administration, to quote the HHS secretary, who literally believes that the reunification is simply doing the kids a favor, that there's no moral obligation, that the way he talks about it is – yeah, they are the victims of what their parents did, exactly what Trump said. And anything more is a favor to them, right? As if us creating 3,000 foster children is a benefit to us. Do you know how expensive this 3 months has been? I mean, I've been looking at the budgeting. You have the Customs and Border Protection is just on this one program, something like 82% over budget, right? You can't sustain this, right? And if you had a unitary mission and goodwill and a command structure and leadership and a desire to do it, you can get a dozen people out of a cave in Thailand. You can do this. You can do this. And it is. I agree with Senator Warren that at this stage, I believe there's people trying hard. But at this stage, the lack of leadership can only be viewed as malfeasance.
We're talking to Julia Kayyem.
This one is a new frontier, I guess, that the Trump administration is now trying to revoke citizenship from people who have become American citizens, but they committed criminal offenses before they became citizens.
Before you tell the story, I didn't even know this was done.
Neither did I.
When is it?
Nazis.
I mean, that's essentially
isn't that's what it was created
war criminals,
for.
Right.
Well, it's basically all these German Nazis tried to come into the United States. They would say, I was either a victim or I hid. We then realized,
after they become naturalized.
Right, and so you have a denaturalized Nazis. Let's just put our standard is Nazis.
Okay, that's
and
what
then you have the.
Okay, tell the story.
So we
I'm
have
sorry,
this, this woman who came here from Peru in 1989. Apparently, she worked as a secretary for a guy who was doing some very, very bad stuff. And when the FBI came down, she agreed to cooperate with the FBI.
She didn't profit at all from this.
She did not profit at all, but she did take a plea deal, so she did do something wrong. But what she ended up was getting 1 year of house arrest, and she had to pay back a fine. She was doing, at her boss's behest, some illegal paperwork. That was her big crime. Meanwhile, she's been a wonderful citizen for years, working, volunteering, being involved with her church. She's a grandmother now. She's 63. They're taking away her citizenship and sending her back to Peru.
Yeah. Yeah.
Been here for 30 years.
I know. Okay. So let's take all the insanity out of it and just look at a resource allocation issue. If MS-13 is as bad as Donald Trump says, why the heck are we spending money on a denaturalization process, which she's clearly going to sue about? I mean, in other words, the idea that they get to just call it, she's going to sue them or she's going to defend herself in court. She's not going to allow this to happen, is absurd. But it's part of a narrative that they've created through the immigration system, through immigration policy, which is, anti people of color. I mean, it is just no question about that is because these are only targeted against people who don't fit the European model of immigration. You don't hear the president. One of the most abused visa processes is the H-1B visa. Why don't you hear the president go after that? Because his wife got in on that,
well,
right?
He's trying to get people at Mar-a-Lago to work
right to
there
work for him. So
H-B-
right,
H-2.
Only him. H-2. That is yeah. That's the H-2. That's not yeah. skilled
oh,
labor.
H-2, excuse me.
H-1B is skilled labor. So so if you put all of these pieces together, it is, you know, cruelty as a form of deterrent so that dark people don't want to come to this country. It is undermining lawful processes by which they could. And then even when you're here and you think you are a citizen, we're going to put a cloud of possible denaturalization around it. And so part of what they're doing is naturalized citizens are not real citizens. And the other proof that they're doing this, right, is not just this denaturalization madness, which, if you're MS-13, you're thinking, thank God they're doing this because I could kill more people, but this story, which I'm going to be careful here because there's some competing reporting, this story that that the Department of Defense is kicking out Army recruits
yes.
who have who've been promised a pathway to citizenship if they serve the nation. My personal feeling is you must be filled with so much hate to deny someone else's desire to die for you, right? Because you want to make some point. I mean, in other words, this person is willing to die for you. I'm not, you know, the recruit. And so I think part of what is going on with the denaturalization is this administration does not believe in a pathway to citizenship, period. Naturalized citizens are a different pool, which many of us are, not me, but many of our family members are, than citizens. And I think if you just put all of these pieces together, that's exactly what they're doing. And that's the white America that they'll win on, and that's why all you can say is they don't have enough of them, people. I mean, that's why everyone is focusing on voting. There's not enough of them.
We only have a minute left. Can you arbitrate a dispute? There's
yes.
no hard data on this. Marjorie and I almost every day have been arguing, discussing how deeply concerned the American people are or are not about these separations.
Yeah,
I fear Marjorie thinks they are. I fear that they've moved on to the next news
no,
cycle.
No, I mean, the polling is very anti-administration. Part of it is, where we don't live, but churches, others. I mean, this is, you can say a lot of things are anti-Christian and not really believe it. This is truly anti-Christian.
And people's you believe
and,
the focus
And his
is,
disapproval ratings over the same period have gone way up. So everyone looks at his approval ratings. I don't care.
I don't even care
his
about the politics, but you think the American people continue
Do you want
to care
them,
in every, a deep way about
every Democrat running in a swing state? You could pay me lots of money. Here's the tape I want. Here's your ad. The wailing children, just dark screen. The sound of the Customs and Border Protection officials sort of making fun of them, of the kids, and then make America kind again, or make America America
well, I
again.
Well, I hope you're right. I hope you and Marjorie are both right. I want it to be that way. I don't mean the ads.
Okay,
I mean,
we have to end on something good. World
I hope
Cup.
It's true.
Who are you for?
Marjorie doesn't even know who's
playing. Oh, my God, yeah, Marjorie. That was
France,
like a blank face
France
coming completely over
England,
you.
Isn't it? France
no, we
no
don't
not
know
yet.
England
oh, my God.
Forget it.
Do you not work in the news? Like, what do you do? Just, like, tune it out?
Okay, they're playing. Somebody's playing Croatia.
England is.
England.
Okay.
We want England versus
Juliet
France. Bye, you guys.
Okay,
see you next week.
Goodbye.
Thank you
bye.
Very much.
Nice to see you, Julia.
Sorry about the soccer.
Football to you.
Whatever it is.
Whatever it is.
I know they're playing a game out there.
Exactly.
National Security Expert,
Julia. The show today so far is 3-0. I just want to make that clear.
What does that mean?
See ya.
I'm losing?
No, it doesn't. You're
National
winning.
Security expert Juliet Kahn joins us every week. She's on the faculty.
I'm losing.
Harvard. I don't know who I am.
And why I am.
I'm why I'm here, but I'm here. Anyway, she's on the faculty at Harvard's Kennedy School and analyst at CNN, CEO of Zemcar. Thank you very much, Juliet. Coming up.
No, by the way, we should say the line that you and I both bastardized is one of our favorite lines in a movie.
From
in Moonstruck. He comes home, was asked by his wife where he's been. He says, I don't know where I've been. I don't know where I'm going. I'll say no more. That's our
it's
motto.
One of the great scenes
ever.
Coming up, are DNA kits helping to unite immigrant families separated at the border, or are they keeping them apart? Medical ethicist Art Kaplan joins for that and a lot more medical news. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Well, Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy, Marge Regan, broadcasting from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Last week, an accident at the MBTA perfectly illustrated our broken healthcare system. When a woman got her leg wedged between the train and the platform, her leg was cut to the bone, and when people came to her rescue, her first words were a plea to not call the ambulance because it cost too much. Should she have been concerned about minding the gap or minding the GOP as it continues to chip away at the Affordable Care Act? Joining us for his take on this, genetic testing at the border and other medical ethical headlines, is Art Kaplan. Art is the Doctors William F. and Virginia Connolly Mitty Chair and the Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU's Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the Everyday Ethics podcast. Hello there, Art Kaplan.
Hey, I'm speaking to you from my Uber. Wouldn't want to go to an ambulance.
Well, I was a little bit confused by this. Is part of this that people have those insurance coverage that is so basic that they get no
high
coverage?
High deductibles, all
is
that
what this is about?
Yeah, it is. Plus ridiculous unchecked rates charged by ambulance services. We hear a lot about back and forth on drug prices. The president has said he's going to try and jawbone price reductions, and apparently he got Pfizer today to stop a price hike, yeah. I guess at least temporarily. But plenty of other drug companies have been raising their prices. But over on the side, ambulance services, which are often private companies, you know, they're cost thousands and thousands of dollars for rides.
By the way, I looked it up yesterday, and I can't remember. The number was somewhere between $1,500 and $3,000 on average for an ambulance ride here in Boston. Yeah.
So who, if you have a gold-plated insurance coverage, does Blue Cross or Harvard Pilgrim pay that? Or, you know, if you're in a car accident, lots of us have been in car accidents when the ambulance comes, and I never recall getting a bill.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to have listeners write to me in anger, but I'm going to say if 1% of insurance policies cover ambulances, it's a lot. I don't
really
think they do.
Really?
Yeah, I don't think they do.
And the rationale for that is what? That they can get away with it? That they can?
They're not hospital-based health services, which tends to be the insurance system that we have. Remember, we don't really have an insurance system for long-term care, right? People mm-hmm. spend down to qualify for Medicaid, but that's a poverty program. It wasn't meant to be a nursing home program. There are a lot of services in healthcare outpatient, genetic testing, our favorite activity at the border these days, not covered because it's preventative services. Obamacare tried to expand a little bit into that area, but we have a health insurance system that's basically built around hospital costs, not getting there, not preventing you from getting there. It's kind of built on once you're there, that's where the insurance hits.
You know, by the way, one thing for people listening to this here, obviously, they know it's a local story, the Orange Line. This became a huge national symbol. It was a lead editorial, or an editorial at least,
in
the New York Times the other day, is symptomatic of what's wrong with our healthcare system, or one of the many things.
No, I would say many. It's one of. You know, we still don't have an adequate mental health system. We still don't have a long-term care system. When we compare our costs to Europe, and, you know, it's often pointed out that we're much more expensive than they are, a lot of those countries fold in the cost of long-term care. I don't know what they do about ambulances, to be honest. And they have better mental health. So we're really paying a lot and getting less.
By the way, just because Marjorie and I have known each other for years to save a little money, I did an implant for her this morning, and she's going to do one on one of my molars next week. So there are ways you can work around the system.
So Art Kaplan,
do-it-yourself healthcare.
Exactly.
So Art Kaplan, another story, one of which you're quoted prominently in, the Trump administration is doing DNA testing with families at the border to make sure that parents who say they're parents of kids actually are parents of kids. But you raise a lot of ethical concerns about this. Tell us.
Well, look, for most kids, if you're, say, I don't know, 10 to 18, I don't think you should be doing DNA tests because you can take a picture of the kid, take a picture of the adults, and they can probably recognize their parents, right? Whether they're their biological relatives or cousin Fred who brought them or whoever. So it's really a policy that you want to go to of last resort. I don't trust the government to get DNA on anybody these days, either immigration or ICE or the administration. I just worry that they won't keep it private and confidential. But there clearly are kids very young, I don't know, five and under, who you probably, since they created this inexcusable mess of separating kids and parents and not knowing where everybody is, that probably there is some use for DNA testing there. The real problem is this, Marjorie. If you do DNA testing, you're going to reveal a certain amount of non-paternity. Some of it may be because people thought that was their kid, and it isn't. And the DNA may show that. Sometimes a DNA test may show incest or some type of familial sexual relations because the DNA is common or repeats itself too much, and that raises issues. And then some of these people clearly were brought here by folks who aren't their biological parents but who act as their parents, and you don't want to say, well, you're not the parent just on the basis of a DNA test alone. So you need counseling. You need sophistication. The government hasn't said who's doing the testing. They haven't said whether there's any counseling as mandatory as part of this, which there ought to be. And they're also not saying who's paying for it. I've seen at least one report that says they're going to ask the people who came in here to pay for it, you know, the folks that they were trying to match up. So it's like break them up and you pay.
You know, Art, one last thing about this. Your analysis, which I hadn't thought much about until I read your comments in the Associated Press story, I share everything. But there's one other possibility here that I think at least deserves attention. One of the excuses the head of Health and Human Services is using for the failure to reunite is because they're concerned that these drug traffickers, you know, the whole the DNA rationale, are bringing these kids in. We want to protect them, etc. I'm not even believing they're doing this testing. I mean, if they are, you are right. This is like, do you remember 2 weeks ago they had reunited 500 families? And it turns out they hadn't reunited anywhere close to 500 families. So I want to see some evidence. I don't mean obviously not with names. I'm not even sure they're doing this, but rather using this as a cover to pretend that their non-compliance with a court order and their cruelness is motivated by some desire to protect children.
The other thing I'm worried about, too, is that there's so much violence in the countries that a lot of these people are coming from that it's not at all inconceivable that many people have informal adoptions of people who've lost their mother or lost their father, or the cousins take the kids in because of all this. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, absolutely.
So it would be awful to have children that have been, you know, formally or informally adopted taken away because the government's going to say that they're with drug smugglers.
Right, or just because they're not DNA related. I mean, there are plenty of people listening to this show whose parents adopted them or...
Excuse me, you're talking to one right here. I am not DNA related to my two daughters.
So there you go. So, you know...
You look like a drug smuggler too, Jimmy. You might be in trouble at the border.
In any case.
And, he's been trying to cross the border into Alston for years now.
That's right.
But... you know, you have all kinds of trouble that the administration says it's on the lookout for: trafficking, stolen children, entry into sex trade, blah, blah, blah. I don't know to the extent that's there. Why isn't all this transparent? Why aren't they just telling us, you know, up front who's doing the testing, which they've never said? Are they any good at it? What counseling is there? Do the people get lawyers if there's some charge about, you know, what they did? Are they going to keep the DNA samples? Are they going to throw them away? Are they going to turn them into a big registry so they can go chase these people around later if they want to do that? I mean, it goes on and on and on. DNA testing's ethically complicated. It just is. And as people who watch daytime TV know, every once in a while, you know, the two guys come out and we try to decide who's the parent, and one is and one isn't, and they're shocked, and that can happen too.
We need Dr. Phil is what we need. So let's go to Nevada. Fentanyl is being used as one of the drugs to execute a convicted killer. Is it the first time it's been done? And two, how bad an idea is this?
First time it's been done, bad idea.
Why?
And it's partly because pharmaceutical companies who made the agents that they used to use to for capital punishment just said, we don't want our drugs used that way, some of them being in Europe where it isn't legal to do capital punishment. So the states have been floundering around trying to find drugs to kill people. And they did notice, I guess, that the opioid epidemic, which is fentanyl, is doing a pretty good job of that. So they started to order it. But because it's not for a pain purpose or a medical purpose, they've had to lie. So they're apparently putting in tiny orders one at a time, you know, building up a stockpile of the drug. No one's ever used it intentionally to kill a prisoner. So how much to use and with what to calm the person down, who knows? You know, whatever your thoughts are about capital punishment, you want to, again, have a transparent protocol to say, this is what we're doing, this is why it's not cruel, this is why you won't suffer. And I don't think they've got that nailed down. They're floundering around desperately, making it up as they go.
You know, Art, to me, there's at least one hopeful thing in the story. As I think most of our listeners know, Anthony Kennedy was the fifth vote on barring the death penalty for people under 18, and some people hope that he'd be the fifth vote to ultimately abolish the death penalty. That's unlikely to happen in the near future, mm-hmm. at least, with the new justice. Is it possible that the end of the death penalty could come through the back door because these drugs, a growing number of drug companies don't want to be associated with it and don't want to provide the agents to kill these people?
Yeah, it reminds me, you know, we've talked a lot about those who oppose abortion. They go at it by restricting the kinds of clinics that are available, what they have to have, the medicines they need to have, the square footage they need to have. Critics of capital punishment are doing the same thing on the drug front. They're basically saying, you're not going to be able to buy these drugs from the manufacturers, and now you're trying to make it up, and we're going to sue you on that. They're taking a backdoor route, if you will, to get rid of capital punishment. No doubt about it.
You know, a couple of last drug things since we're talking about drugs. You mentioned in passing the Pfizer thing, and it seems to me, unless I'm missing something, to Donald Trump's credit, we've had discussions with you in the past that he railed against the drug companies, and I think it was in February, a month after he took over in 2017, mm-hmm. they came to the Oval Office and he did a total 180. He tweets out that Pfizer should be ashamed of themselves, they're taking advantage of the poor, when they raised prices on 100-plus drugs on July 1st, and they've flipped on their position not in great part, apparently totally, because of being called out by the president.
Well, I'm always looking for good things for him to do.
I know, but
how
do you explain this? So he flipped and then he
broken
flipped
clock
again.
Twice a day.
No, is that really what you think it is?
Yeah. I mean, we haven't had any systematic reform. What's he going to do, call out company by company every time they try to raise prices? It's crazy.
Well, but let me interrupt you. I would argue that if I was the next drug company, I might not have to be called out because I'd worry that I was going to be called out. So maybe I shouldn't do the drug price increase as sort of preventatively. Is that naive?
Yeah, it could be, although four or five companies this week raised prices too, and they didn't roll back today.
Okay.
So I don't know. Although I do notice that Trump on his way to NATO told the Germans they had cut a bad deal with the Russians on gas supply, so he seems to be very available for critiquing prices on many things. But, you know, we got to have some reform here of drug prices that goes beyond jawboning by the president. I mean, fine, but, you know, okay, he called them out, and that's good. I'm glad of that. But I want to see some structural fix in here. Are we going to say, you know, your patents can't be extended by these bogus means so that you keep a monopoly and charge what you want, which is a trick that's still an open door for drug companies? Are we going to see people told, look, the government's going to exercise bargaining power, and if you want to sell us drugs for Medicare, the VA, the military, Medicaid, you have to sit at the table and negotiate a price? That's the structural fix we need. Just saying, Company X raised its prices, and that's really bad. That's not a fix. That's just it's kind of a Band-Aid.
We're talking Art Kaplan, our medical ethicist.
So, Art Kaplan, back to something that doesn't seem like a good idea from the Trump administration at all, is this meddling in this United Nations Global Health meeting about a resolution that was just intended to support breastfeeding, which I think most studies say is the best route to go for infants.
Do you have like a censorship button near you? I mean,
7-second delay.
Button you hit. Yeah.
Yeah. Get ready, John. The 7-second delay.
I would now like to swear for a few minutes here. I mean, are you kidding me?
I know.
We're going to come into the international organization with a pretty harmless resolution that says, let's promote breastfeeding, and we're going to tell the country that proposed it, Ecuador, that we're going to beat them up, act like thugs if they don't pull this thing off the table because people ought to have a right to get formula. Look, people have a right to get formula anyway. That's never been an issue for Nestle or other big formula manufacturers. The problem is, a lot of those companies have used bogus science to impugn the value of breastfeeding. You do want to encourage it. I'm not trying to be a nag about it if women can't do it or there's, you know, health reasons that they can't do it, HIV and stuff. Formula's great, and it's a good way to turn if it doesn't work out for the breastfeeding. But that's really a moral low of the year to see us at WHO saying, oh, no, we're not going to let you put that. And by the way, when the Russians propose it, we run away.
By the way, unfortunately, we had to bleep all of that out. What Art essentially said was this is a really bad idea.
This was about making money for a breast.
For the formula
for
companies.
The formula companies,
yeah.
Right? That's what
I mean, I don't see any other way to read it. What's the other side of this? We don't want people breastfeeding in the mall. I mean, you know, there's no downside to promoting breastfeeding unless you're trying to get people to use and pay for formula.
Okay. All right, Kaplan. So this and next story, I'm not going to mention it because I did not do a thorough investigation, but I went to go visit somebody in a rehabilitation center a couple of months ago at about 8 o'clock on a Sunday night, and I was stunned. I walked in. There was nobody greeting me at the entranceway. I walked all through this place. Nobody was there. I mean, you had to,
you were in the right place, right?
I was in the right place, and it was okay. Really kind of creepy, and I thought of that.
Just making sure you didn't get a Toys R Us or something.
Yeah. This was a rehab center which dealt with young people, like in car accidents or strokes, whatever, and older people that were in nursing care. And then I read this story talking about it's like a ghost town was a quote about nursing homes that are grossly understaffed.
And they're lying about their staffing because I assume Medicare reimbursement is in part or Medicaid a function of staffing.
Well, it said under Obamacare that they had to prove that what their numbers were. Previously, they'd been able to just say what their numbers were. And apparently, many of them were lying.
And accreditation for them relies on certain staffing numbers. I don't know why anybody's shocked about this. Maybe they haven't been there like you were, Marjorie, at a rehab place or a nursing home. Even the hospitals. Sometimes people say to me, you know, I want to get an elective procedure. And I sometimes say, look, maybe not on the weekend.
Yeah,
why don't you do it during the week?
Not
better
terrible.
Staffing. At night, staff ratio goes way down. Also, you get more part-time people coming in. You get swing shift people coming in who aren't really trained up in the culture of the institution or don't know it as well. We do have, and we have pretty good data that says staffing helps when you're in rehab or nursing homes. But just to take your example, it's not like rehab shouldn't be done on the weekend. As a person here with my bionic knee, I think it's important to do your rehab every day. So you need help and you need your staff. And the institutions are basically cheating. You get a lot of, again, for-profit long-term care and rehab, and they see the chance to squeeze down the resources, lie about it, and make some more money. It's part of the reason I still am not convinced that we ought to have for-profit health care.
Do they ever get prosecuted? I mean, it's essentially stealing money from the federal government.
You got to really go at it to get prosecuted. I won't say never, but you need big numbers.
We're talking to Art Kaplan. So, Art, what's the everyday ethics kind of thing? What's your podcast this week?
So this week we're taking a look at the claim that we ought to get more civility in our public dialogue about things. Remember
Red Hen?
We got calls for that. Civility is much in the air these days when somebody feels bothered or taunted. I find it crazy that the president's spokeswoman can call for civility when the president is tweeting up a storm about, in an uncivil way about Pocahontas or whoever he's beating up on his daily outbursts. I happen to think that civility is like disarmament at this point. So I'm not a big fan of civility. I think you got to go at your critic and your opposition pretty hard. I'm not saying you have to threaten them or bully them, but I don't know about – I think civility is a – it seems to me to be a political ploy.
Yeah, I'm glad you came down on that. I wasn't here for your civility discussion, Jim.
No, you're on vacation.
I don't know if you were pro-civility or not pro-civility. Were you pro or contra against it?
It depended. I was worried that I was going to get thrown out of some restaurant in Cambridge if I didn't say the right thing, so I decided to straddle the fence.
Okay,
the
yeah, I'm with you on this, Art. I'm with you.
So if I'm eating lunch and you want to come up and say, that's the worst segment I ever heard on the radio, you can tell me. I'm all right. It's okay.
Art, it's a pleasure as always. Art Kaplan,
good to talk to
you.
Good luck with the knee. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Talk to you later.
Art Kaplan joins us every week. He's a doctor's William F. from Virginia Conley Meeting Chair and Director of the Division of Medical Ethics at NYU Langone Medical Center. He's also the co-host of the terrific Everyday Ethics podcast. WGBH Arts Editor Jared Bowen is here for his rundown on the latest art events in and around town. You are listening to 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio, and we are broadcasting today and do every Wednesday from the WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library. He's Jim Browdy.
And she's Marjorie Egan.
And this is 89.7 WGBH, WGBH HD1, Boston.
Online at WGBHnews.org.
Boston's local NPR.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Joining us to take us into a dream world by way of the magical realism of Cirque du Soleil and the dreamscapes on exhibit at the De Cordova Museum is GBH's executive arts editor, Jared Bowen. He's the host of Open Studio, which you can catch Friday nights at 8:30 here on Channel 2. Hello, Jared Bowen.
Hello.
Hello.
So, Jared Bowen, the headline in the Globe about the Cirque du Soleil was that it's as interested in awe as wow. So, what did Donald Coyne mean by that? Or the headline writer, I should say. Well, but Donald Coyne wrote the review. What do you mean?
Well, first of all, let me just say that I have seen so many of these Cirque du Soleil shows now, and so many that each time I go in thinking, all right, this is going to be the one that doesn't quite measure up. How could they possibly, after all that I've seen, this was not the one where that happened. They have crafted another really extraordinary show here. For me, and maybe what Don meant as well in writing in the Globe, was I thought the aesthetics here were absolutely gorgeous. It was one of the most beautiful Cirque du Soleil productions I have ever seen. And what they do here, of course, it's all circus at the end of the day, and it's acts and it's clowns that entertain you, but it's always around some sort of theme. And as Jim mentioned, this is around the folklore of Mexico and the beauty of Mexico, which I think, and for all that I've seen, this is the first time that they've actually centered on a specific country like this. But the way they've crafted it, they have this great puppetry, wonderful costumes. They use water for the first time in a traveling show. They have O out in Las Vegas, which I've seen, which is spectacular. But here, they have water that rains down on the stage and creates a pool. I mean, it's just really beautiful to watch. And of course, this is all under the big top that they erect at Suffolk Downs.
What's this thing called again?
Lucia.
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 So the answer to your question is what Donald Coyne meant from Jared is he has no idea. Is that essentially?
No, but he did. That's what he was talking about. That there was a real serene beauty to parts of it as opposed to just the...
Have you gone to Cirque, by the way? I don't even know. Have you gone?
I went to one years ago.
Oh, don't say you didn't like it.
No, I did.
It is...
I did, but it was like, you can't believe these people are doing these things. That's what the thing that I was always coming away with. Look at these bodies and these...
And I think I've shared with you that I have done several stories with them behind the scenes in the past, and this is all they do. They work out all day. They have physical therapists and massage therapists that work with them because they're constantly honing these acts that they do. And here, they're tumbling over the audience practically. It feels like they're going to come out. There's a male contortionist that I feel like I've never seen a male contortionist before who almost takes on the guise of a cobra. And the way he's moving is very chilling. It's not very comfortable to watch, I have to say, but it's riveting nonetheless. nonetheless. And then you have the, sort of the old-style strongman competition. But again, going back to the aesthetics of puppetry, I mean, one of the most beautiful moments I had, I think it was this image of this butterfly kind of drawing a horse forward. It's just absolutely stunning. It really calms you down and brings you all together. And
yeah.
then they have the clown that comes out as sort of the release valve for each of these acts, whether it's really stressful or really beautiful. So you have these wonderful transitions.
I haven't seen this one yet. I'm going to. I feel the same way you do. You're never disappointed. You think they can't top or equal what you've seen before, but they are. Every one is spectacular.
And you know what I noticed this time, and I don't know why I hadn't completely focused on this before, but everywhere you look on stage, something is happening. Somebody's in a beautiful mm-hmm. costume. They're performing. Even if they're by themselves, they're doing something. Nothing is incidental on that stage.
I'm thinking of floating over our audience here, actually, Marjorie.
That's
in cobra-like fashion.
As if you don't do that into the newsroom every day. For anybody who's not at GBH, this is how Jim enters our newsroom.
Jim, of course, is above the fray.
Exactly.
At every
that's
moment.
My point. Thank
but,
you.
You know, this picture, this performer is essentially doing a split in the air.
And you have no idea from that picture how high up. He keeps putting these poles one after the next, and you're thinking, how can he do this? You start to look away after a while.
We're talking to Jared Bone. You know, Jared, I remember our conversation a couple of years ago. We're talking about Emerson, where you were a celebrated grad. My younger kid went there, too, about how Emerson, which is doing wonderful things downtown, was about to disgrace itself by converting the Colonial into a dining hall or some such thing.
Yeah.
Luckily, there was an outcry, and Lee Pelton, as the president, listened to the voices of the public and relented. They've now reopened. I've only seen the photographs. I have to say the photographs in the Globe are so spectacular. It is unbelievable. What'd they do?
Well, wait till you see Open Studio this week when we talk about the Colonial. Yesterday I was sitting with the edit. It looks gorgeous on camera, too. But what they have done, and I'm so glad that I can laugh about this now, the fact that they might turn it into a dining hall, because that is well in the past. And what they have done is they have turned over the lease to Ambassador Theatre Group, a London-based theatre group. And they have taken over the lease, and they are opening it with reopening the Colonial after what I assume they won't give the actual number is a multi-million-dollar renovation and restoration that really returns the Colonial to what it was. It's always been in good shape. They were doing shows there until just a few years ago, but they have taken great care to refurbish all of the murals. And what I've been able to do is kind of do a deep dive into the history. It opened in 1900. This is a time in which, of course, people weren't really traveling as readily as they can today. So this was designed to bring people to Europe, essentially. So you walk in and you see these Roman and Greek motifs in the main promenade just outside the auditorium. As they joked, Erica Schwartz, who's the general manager, jokes, it's like King Louis XIV's dining room. I mean, it's absolutely beautiful with mirrors that were meant to mirror the Hall of Versailles. And then you enter into the auditorium, absolutely exquisite. It will be different for people. You might remember it had red walls, scarlet red walls. Some of them are from Moulin Rouge. But as they were doing restoration, they went beneath layers of paint and realized the original color was teal. And they say that makes sense. If you look at the murals, it all ties in together. And so they have improved access. They've improved the seating.
Emerson still owns the place.
Emerson still owns it, but Ambassador Theatre Group is now
long-term lease. Right?
Holds the lease. So they do Moulin Rouge. They'll bring in several of the Broadway and Boston shows you'll find there, and then they'll start doing concerts. They have Heather Headley coming. I think they just announced something with the Byrds and Rufus Wainwright. So it'll be all sorts of different programming.
Can I just tell you, do you know who Rufus Wainwright is?
Yeah,
he's Loudon Wainwright's kid.
Yeah.
I have been. Are you Rufus?
Wait, he's whose kid?
Loudon Wainwright's son.
I didn't realize that.
And let me just say about this. There is a. You know when you get fixated on a song and can't stop watching the thing? Have you seen him, the piece he's done of a Sting song with Sting? I'll think of what the song is in a couple of seconds. It is one of the greatest covers I have ever heard in my whole life.
Really?
Do you know who he is? Have you ever heard
him?
You
can't even tell us the song, Jim,
I'll think
so
about
we're upset.
I'll tell you what it is in a second.
Okay, think about that, and we'll continue on while you look that up.
When is Rufus Wainwright there?
I think it's later this fall. And you just made me realize I've never seen him. I've only seen his sister. Have you seen his sister, Martha Wainwright?
He performs
Wainwright?
With his sister from time to time. Wrapped around your
Wrapped
finger.
Wrapped around
you, John
your finger.
Parker.
Thank you, John.
And you know that song.
Okay, I do know
Thank
that
you.
Song.
Yeah,
want to sing a few bars?
No, I do not. Thank you very much. But Rufus does a very fun
One other thing I just want to say about Ambassador Theatre Group. It's all about hospitality. And we'll be talking about a few more Broadway shows that I saw in New York recently, and I know you did too, Jim, I think. But I was really struck. Sometimes you pay a lot of money to go into these shows, and you're treated like dirt, like, stand over here, put your camera away, do this, do that. And they're all about hospitality. I went to one of the theaters in New York, and it felt like you're walking into a restaurant.
Really?
Welcome. How can we help you? What can we do? It So I think you'll have a whole different feel when you walk into the Colonial.
We're talking to Jared Bowen,
and
obviously.
What a tragedy averted. Imagine if it had gone the way
Dining hall is always good as an asset to a community.
It's true. We always think that. Okay, what is going on with this? This sounds fantastic. This World War II exhibit all about women in the war in Natick?
Yeah.
It's in Natick about the war.
Thanks for clarifying that. Hopefully there's no one causing any concern.
The International Museum of World War II, which is in Natick, has a new exhibition. It's called Women in World War II on the Home Fronts and the Battle Fronts. And this takes a look at a story that's often less told, but what women were doing in the war in the United States, in Great Britain, in Russia, where, by the way, they're among the only conscripted women drafted into the war. They were snipers in the Soviet Union during World War II. What they were doing in Great Britain, they have a fabulous picture of then Princess Elizabeth with the Queen Mum looking over, then Queen Elizabeth looking over her shoulder. She's elbow deep into a car. She was doing mechanics during the war. I mean, everybody did their part. And they tell all of these.
Wait,
really,
who was doing mechanics?
Queen Elizabeth, as she was princess. Yeah. Oh,
did she have her pocketbook with her? She always has.
No, she was just Princess Elizabeth. She just had her on her outfit ready to do the car. You see all those great documentaries, and she's tooling through the countryside, driving herself.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't you get a kick out of her with that pocketbook, though? I always found that amazing.
Well, what's in the pocketbook?
Well, that's what I was wondering.
Little corgis in the pocketbook.
Oh yeah, she does. Little corgi puppies.
When you're the queen, can't you say to one of your associates, "I need my hairbrush or my lipstick"? You know what I mean? Why do you have to carry that little purse? Who knows what's going on there?
Because maybe it's something that can't be handed over.
Ooh.
What could that be?
Excuse me.
A nuclear button?
Exactly.
Let's hope not.
So,
okay. So it's really good. We should see it.
Oh, and one other thing I just want to mention, is something that really you've not been able to see before, is a series of photographs by Ansel Adams of women here in Massachusetts. In 1942, the government asked him to come here and take pictures of the Massachusetts Women's Defense Corps. And this is as they're doing all of these things to prepare the home front in case there was an attack here. So you see them dealing with being a part of the fire brigade or rescues. And I mean, obviously, as the men went off to war, who were the people that were running the country? It was women. And so all of those stories are told that the post office jobs, the sanitation jobs, all the jobs that women stepped into as the guys were gone. And then it's pretty poignant because you think then the men came back and the women had to, quote unquote, take their place again, and which
kitchen.
Is a hard thing to do once you've been doing all this
stuff. Once you've been off the farm.
Born for This. What's the day? It's sort of speaking of Don O'Coin, who apparently Marjorie is focused on here. Don's review was mixed, I should say. What's your review?
Largely good, but with one quibble, which I'll get to in a moment. But this is a really pretty interesting story. This is a story that B.B. Winans, you probably know the famed Winans family, B.B. and C.C. Winans, that he has crafted. This musical is playing at, speaking of Emerson, it's presented by Arts Emerson at the Cutler Majestic just through Sunday. And this is his life story. He wants to get this to Broadway, by the way, so this might be your last chance to see it before it goes to New York. And it tells a story of how he and Cece were young kids growing up in Detroit. Their older siblings were performing. They were kind of having all the success in their family, doing gospel singing. And then they were, through an audition, they were hired by Jim and Tammy Faye Baker and the Praise the Lord Network. So here you have these kids going from, you know, an African-American family in Detroit, suddenly going to the South and dealing with those issues, a very white South, and this time, which was I think around the 70s and then into the 80s. And so they're singing for the Praise the Lord Network, and then suddenly they find this incredible success. People are paying attention to them more than everybody else who's wearing their pastel colors and scarves. And so they essentially were raised by Jim and Tammy Faye Baker while they were part of the Praise the Lord Network, and then
I was obsessed with the two of them.
Yeah. By the way, there's a new book out about them, and we got, have you read it yet?
No.
Sitting in my car, a publicist, who's actually a fan of our show, I should say, sent me a copy the other day, and I'm dying to have the author on. That was a cultural phenomenon. PTL, if you're a real viewer, we call it PTL, not Praise the Lord, I should say.
Yeah, they were this couple. There was a scandal involving him later on.
Major. He's still in jail, and he's still...
I didn't know that. He is?
He's still in touch with B.B. Winans. I mean, despite what the, so the scandal was, of course, that he was in, so there was a Christian network. They were taking in all of this money to supposedly for their efforts, but then it was, of course, revealed that it was embezzlement. He was having an having affairs with both men and women, I believe.
Good
and,
for him. Yeah.
So where's so, how's Tammy Faye doing if he's in jail?
I think she is no longer. Is she with us?
No,
I don't think she is.
Oh, okay.
No. In any case, so what's your what you said you had one hesitation about Born for This. What is it?
Yeah, so it documents everything that they did in their rise, including with Whitney Houston, who used to come and sing with them because she loved their gospel singing and she loved being with them. And there are only allusions to what struggles B.B. Winans had, maybe some gambling, maybe some drinking issues, was trying to struggle with being away from home and the sudden fame they got. And it doesn't do a deep dive into that. I think if you're really going to tell your whole story, I think it would make it even more interesting. That said, really majestic voices and powerhouse musical numbers here.
I know it's not on our list for today. I'm assuming we'll do it soon. You haven't seen the Whitney Houston thing yet, have
not
you?
Yet.
Have you?
No.
Yeah, I am dying to
Me too.
See
yeah.
this. Came out last Friday. We're talking to Jared Bowen, executive arts editor. Thank you very much.
So what's going on up at the DeCordova?
This
we know. Should say, by the way, we've been trying to discuss this exhibit with Jared for about 6 months.
Not six months.
And every week we run out of time, so we're getting to this baby today. Go ahead, tell us about it.
And with good time, it's on view until September 30th. Normally you go to the DeCordova Sculpture Park and Museum to be outdoors in the great landscape and see the outdoor sculpture. This is a reason to go inside, though. A show called Sculpting with Air. It's curated by Martina Tanga. And this is a show that really invites slow looking. At first you think, what are they talking about, sculpting with air? But there are two artists here who are having their first museum shows. The first is Ian McMahon, and he's created this massive sculpture, the largest, I believe, that he's done for inside a museum. It was created over 3 weeks, 65 feet long, 25 feet wide, 5,500 pounds. And what he does, he has this process where he creates this armature, then inflates sheets of plastic, and then plasters over the plastic. After that dries, he takes the plastic away, so you're left with this big structure with all the creases. It looks like a duvet or giant pillows that he creates, but it's very ephemeral, and it's destroyed afterward. And this is something that he's done in other venues, and often they're not doing this at the DeCordova, but he'll have a big ceremony where it's destroyed, and people watch the art come down. It just disappears, and it stays in your memory. But you go downstairs in the DeCordova, you see these drawings and images that he's created, and they almost take on these personalities. They're like little figures, these pieces of air. The second piece, the second installation, I should say, is by Jong Oh, and he is somebody who just basically walks into a room, gives himself time, and then, as the title suggests, begins sculpting with air. Here, he walked into this bare room, saw a thread coming out of the carpet, and used that as a springboard. And he uses indents in the wall and wire hanging down that he'll create to create these planes, and you're not quite sure if you're looking at glass or other images, and it invites very slow looking.
Well, but you haven't answered the question, I'm sure, in everybody's mind, which is, what did Don O'Coin think of this? Oh, no.
Are you trying to do a cage match?
Well, he's a very good reviewer.
He's a fine person.
He's got a really talented
too.
Son, I think.
He has a very. He's also a friend of mine.
Yeah. What is his son?
His son. Didn't you tell me his son is about, who's about 11?
Yeah.
Is about to, we had him on the show last year. Isn't he about to write a piece for the
Met? Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. His son.
He's in his mid twenties,
right? Matt O'Coin. He did Crossing, which the ART had here. He's been all over the world conducting. He's doing pieces for the Met. I mean, the young man is extraordinary. He will be one of the greats. There's no question.
And he's not really 11.
So thank you for reminding me that I don't have a son who
he's
is
close to, he's
turned
close
around
to 11.
Yeah, no, he's got to be at least in his 20s.
He's
in his 20s. Mid 20s,
yeah.
I think.
Okay. Yeah.
So Hancock's Door before you go, and the reason I want to squeeze this in today is because where was his house? I never thought of this before until I read about this. Where was his house on Beacon Hill? Do you know?
It was right next to the State House.
Really?
So John Hancock, of course, famous signer and governor of Massachusetts, his house was next to what is now the State House in Massachusetts, of course, added on Beacon Hill. And in 1863, his house was torn down, and elements were saved, including his front door, which is now on view in this exhibition Through the Keyhole, presented by the Bostonian Society at the Old State House. But even in 1863, there was an epic debate about you couldn't possibly tear down the home of one of the founding fathers of this country, but they did. It had gone into the hands of his family, and basically developers got a hold of it, and that was the end of that. But what it did was precipitate the modern preservation movement so that it wouldn't happen again, including places like the old State House, which
really?
At one point they thought they might take down. But what you find in this exhibition is his front door and a lot of artifacts from the Hancock family, and it's in the room where it happens. He was a legislator in this chamber where you find this exhibition. But it's a really interesting way to look at history. They also are presenting a play through this summer. It's called Cato and Dolly, about his slave and his wife. So it's not just about John Hancock, but all of the other people who are part of that history, that home.
Where's the door been for 150 years?
It's been in their collection. They work with the North Bennett Street School that went back and looked at old illustrations and old pictures to create what it looked like around the door. So there are a lot of different elements and people involved in making this show, which I thought was very personal and quite neat.
So what's an open studio?
This week, we'll take, as we mentioned, the restoration of the colonial. We'll take you there. We'll show you some of the history,
neat.
Including all the people, Ethel Merman, Katharine Hepburn, who performed on that stage. And then we will sit down with the stars of Moulin Rouge, which has just opened in previews. So you'll get a sense of
that.
We
have Ethel Merman on Friday. We've been trying to get her for months, by the way.
Good luck with that.
With no success.
Yeah. So. I made sure she won't do any other shows.
Okay.
That's not right. Jared, it's great to see
you.
We'll be watching Friday night.
Ethel Merman.
What?
She could really belt it out.
She could. She really could.
Jared Bowen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
See you, Jared.
Jared Bowen joins us every week. He's WGBH's executive arts editor and host of Open Studio. We just talked about it. It's going to be centering now at the Colonial Theater. It's reboot, for lack of a better word. You can catch Open Studio Friday nights at 8:30 right here on WGBH Channel 2. Thank you very much, Jared. Up next, we are getting a preview of Tom Rush's latest album, Voices. He's next on 89.7 WGBH, broadcasting live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. You know, yesterday we were talking to food writer Corby Kummer about what seemed like the highest praise that could be bestowed upon anyone. ESPN was describing competitive eater Joey Chestnut, he won the hot dog eating contest, as having, quote, the esophagus of a champion. But he's been outdone by this. Listen to this review. His voice is still molasses, smoke and licorice. His fingers still coax magic and thunder from every guitar string. That's a review of musician and folk legend Tom Rush. Tom's latest album is Voices. He'll be performing at the fabulous venue, the Center for Arts in Natick. It is spectacular. We'll talk about it in a minute. This Friday and Saturday night at 8 o'clock. And yes, when the chair of the Cannabis Control Commission an hour ago looked at our rundown and said, wait a second, is that the same guy who sang Circle Game? The answer is yes. Tom Rush, it's good to see you.
Good to be here.
How does it feel to have a fan in the chair of the Massachusetts Cannabis Control Commission, Tom Rush?
Well, I don't know what to say about
that. I didn't think you would, actually. It's nice to see you.
I'm speechless.
So I want to know something. Did you not ever smoke?
I did smoke. I was doing two packs a day for quite a while, up until I quit on my 30th birthday.
So you quit fairly young.
Haven't looked back. But
yeah,
I was worried that it was going to wreck my voice to stop smoking.
Really? Because it wrecks your voice to keep smoking. Why did you think that?
I know that now. But back then, I guess I was looking for excuses.
Oh,
didn't hurt Brenda Vaccaro. Isn't that the woman who had that? Whatever it was. So, you know what I was amazed? I love this CD, and you were kind enough to send it to Marjorie and me early before it was publicly released.
It's beautiful.
What I was not aware of until I started reading about it, you have performed on this CD a third of the original songs you have ever performed on any CD of yours. Is that true?
Some reviewer came up with this statistic, but apparently I have up to now only recorded 20 of my own songs.
In your whole career?
In my whole career. And now there's 10 more on this project. I wrote them all except for two traditional songs.
Wow. Well, you know, the reason that I asked about the smoking is because one of the people you did write songs for, the famous Joni Mitchell, her voice got lower and lower and lower as she got older. And
right.
I remember the last album she made, her voice was still good, but it was a smoking voice,
yeah,
you know?
Kind of a raspy
thing. Yeah, so it's a good thing not to smoke.
It is. But I had kind of a gravelly voice, and I was afraid it was going to get too clean when I stopped smoking. But
is there a concept to this thing, Tom Rush, this voices thing of yours?
Not really.
What is
it? There's not an overarching thing.
So for those who haven't heard it yet, and they're going to hear some of it live in a couple of seconds, where did it come from?
I don't know. I just all of a sudden started writing a bunch of songs. And they're all over the lot, as with most of my projects. There's a silly one and a really serious one and everything in between. The album was number 6 on the Billboard Bluegrass charts for a week.
Really?
And I have no idea what song they thought might be bluegrass on this project.
But how satisfying is it to be doing your own stuff?
I like it. I've always, I've never really paid much attention to who wrote the songs. If I like the song, I get into performing it. But it's never happened before where I've always done a few of the other people's songs and a couple of my own. And
a couple of people we've heard of, we'll talk about in a few minutes. So do you want to can we just play something rather than doing small talk, and we'll do small talk?
Yeah, and then I have some very important questions when we get back.
I bet you do. What are you playing?
This is one of the tunes off the project called Come See About Me.
Great.
Hey, little mama, come see about me. See how your daddy done. Hey, little mama, come see about me. Round about the setting sun. Might be good, might be bad. Might be happy, but it might be sad. Hey, little mama, come see about me. Coming down the road, take me by the hand. Hey, little mama, coming down the road, take me to the promised land. I might be up, might be down, might be lost, but I might be found. Hey, little mama, come see about me.
From Voices.
You get a lot of picks on your fingers. Do you always do that?
Only 3.
Yeah, only 3?
Thumb pick, 2 finger picks.
Is that so they won't hurt your fingers?
It makes a slightly different sound on the strings.
Yeah.
And it doesn't hurt my fingers.
And you get that little plastic thing for the one that slid up and down strings.
That's glass, a glass slide.
Yeah. You buy those at the guitar stores?
Yeah.
Just wondered.
I used to use just plain old broken off bottlenecks. It's called bottleneck guitar because of that.
Is that right?
Yeah, the blues guys in the South didn't have guitar stores, so they just used whatever was lying.
Well, you know
around.
What? That great sound. Make that. Can you just make that sound one more time? You make it with the glass because it's really.
Sure.
I just wanted to mention how. Okay. I mean, you hear that all the time, but you don't, because I don't see it. I didn't realize that you had the little glass thing on your finger.
Yeah.
We're talking to Tom Rush's new CD. Well, I shouldn't say just CD. His new album is called Voices. Speaking of that, when you walked in a couple of minutes ago, you handed us not a CD, but a vinyl copy of voices. I was we were in New York visiting my younger daughter the other day, and she was telling me in a very haughty fashion, you don't know music unless you listen on vinyl. And I felt like saying, what the hell do you know about this? Do you feel the same way? I mean, and then we got into a whole thing, and she said she can tell, and she's not a musician, by the way, she can tell the difference between listening to vinyl and listening to a CD. She says vinyl is hugely better. It's having a huge comeback kind of thing, assuming people are buying turntables. Where are you on this
with
thing?
A certain age group.
Well, my kid is 24, so she's not in that age group. Oh, is that the age group you mean?
Yeah.
So what's that about? Yeah. Is it the quality of the sound?
Well, I think they do sound better.
Do you really think that?
I do. I do. I mean, unless it's an old scratchy copy, but it's I don't know, it's warmer somehow.
Well, you're talking about, I mean, you see these little turntables people have now, but of course when vinyl was big and we all had, we had the big speakers and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's not, I mean, listening on a turntable is really not very good, is it?
Well, except Tom Rush and my daughter are both saying it's got but a don't warmer, you have richer
to have
sound.
Don't you have to have the nice speakers to go with it?
Now, what I tell the audiences, at TCAN tomorrow and Saturday nights, in Natick.
I thought it was Friday and Saturday night.
It is Friday. You're right.
Friday and Saturday night.
I lost a day there.
It's okay.
Friday, Saturday.
Friday, don't goof it up.
Let's hope it goes on the right day is all I can say. Go ahead there, Tom.
Tell the audience, if you don't have a turntable, don't worry, because there's a download card in the LP, so you can download the music and then sit there and hold the album jacket.
Well, you just told them that.
And pretend you're back in college.
I love that.
Well, the album jacket is one of the tragedies of people
totally
getting away
agree.
From, because that was so much fun.
Yeah.
Hey, can we talk for one second, and then I want to talk to you a little bit about the past. TCAN, for those who don't know, I rave about it all the time. First time I ever went was actually to hear you a couple of years ago. This is this small, beautiful, well, you tell the story. It is a fabulous venue.
It's an art center, and they're growing all the time. They've now got a movie theater on the second floor and blah, blah, but it's a tiny little seats about 200 people, and it's very intimate. The sound is excellent, and they've got everything you could want. And I play there once a year for two nights.
And by the way, I've seen it every single. He's spectacular there. I've seen talk about genres. Peter Wolfe and his band. I saw a few months ago there. Joan Osborne. I mean, it's just if you want intimate setting with somebody whose work you really admire, and you're my idol, as I've said, when I was a little boy, and you were a little bit older, little boy. This is the place to go, TCAN. Just check it out. You did this thing.
I will have Matt Nakoa with me on keyboards.
Otherworldly.
Monster. He's a monster.
He's a young guy too.
Yeah,
he can really play. You did this in Nashville. He came down with you to Nashville. Did he not?
Came down to Nashville.
Why'd you do Nashville for this?
I did my previous album with Jim Rooney, my old buddy from the Club 47 days, producing, and it was so much fun working with these musicians that I really wanted to go back and do it. But Matt blew him away down there. He was doing a solo on something. I heard one of the guys say to another, I don't think he's from around here.
We're talking about Tom Rush.
These are some of the best players in the world.
Yeah, well, he's pretty spectacular.
And he knocked
too.
Him off their feet.
Speaking of club, how do you describe to somebody who isn't around in those days, what was the scene like at Club 47 when virtually every huge soon-to-be folk god was just getting his or her start? What was it like then?
It was a little 80-seat room, kind of run down and shabby. There were people fixing their motorcycles in the basement.
Oh, God.
And it was a jazz room and kind of struggling. And then for whatever reason, the women that ran it decided to hire Joan Baez one night. And the second time there was a line down the block, and it was, from there on in, they started doing folk music. But you're right. All the, Baez played there. Dylan played. I don't think he had a gig there, but he'd stop in and do a guest song or two.
And you were a Harvard kid. Did you end up there because you were at Harvard?
Well, yeah. My dorm was one block away, which was dangerous. But the other thing about the Club 47 was they made a point of bringing in the old-timers, the legends. Mm-hmm. And you could sit in this 80-seat room and listen to the Carter family, Flatt & Scruggs, Bill Monroe. A lot of the old blues guys came and played there, and it was just such it was fabulous. And there was usually a party after the show, and we'd go over to Betsy Siggins' house and hang out. And
tell us about Betsy.
Betsy was, she ran the club for a while. She was married to Bob Siggins, banjo player who was in the Charles River Valley Boys. It was a tight-knit little family.
Yeah. But you know what's amazing? You always think of, I mean, when I was a kid, which was when you were a kid, you kind of thought people would like have this burst in their 20s and 30s and that would be it. People have gone on and on and on. I mean, you've been playing all these years. Joan Baez played for ages. Dylan, you know, won the Nobel Prize. I mean, so it's if you don't smoke too many cigarettes, I guess you can go on forever, right?
John Prine's new album is a lot of fun too. I just got a copy of his new album. Anyway, there's a bunch of us people my age out there.
So I get something. I got an email from you yesterday. It was about being in Natick, but it was also a little bit about politics. You're into the political scene at the moment, or urging people to get into the political scene?
I've spent all these years staying away from the political side, but it's getting to the point where you just can't not say something. I think it was the newsletter you're talking about.
Yes.
I lead off with, if you see something, say something, isn't just about airport security anymore.
Yeah.
There's just so much nasty stuff going on that hopefully in November some redirection will happen.
Well, you see a lot of activism. I mean, I don't think I've seen this much activism. The Women's March after Trump was elected, the biggest march we've ever had in the world.
Yeah.
I mean, it's the activism that we're seeing with all these marches. Really, we haven't seen since we were marching.
Since you were playing at Club 47.
No, but since the Vietnam War protests.
Yeah,
I mean,
those days.
So that's kind of cool that people are taking to the streets in a way they haven't in generations.
It's, you know, I think we're the ones who are going to have to make America great again by standing up and waking up and getting involved.
So who's doing folk music now in 2018? Who are the young Turks in the folk music scene?
I don't know. You know, folk to me is traditional songs.
Yeah.
Barbary Allen and Jimmy Crack Corn and stuff like that. So I don't know who's doing traditional folk anymore. The singer-songwriters that I like, Matt Nakoa, my accompanist, is also on his way up the ladder very quickly. My hope is that when he's playing stadiums, I get to open the shows.
You know, speaking of him and Tekan, again, I've been every single year you've been there. You do a mix of your new stuff, and obviously with the new album, you're going to do that, and some of your traditional stuff. We were talking about Joni Mitchell, who's my all-time favorite. There's one of her CDs, or albums at the time, she is talking, and she says, someone yells out, I don't know, case of you or something, and her response is something like, not condescending, it's going to come out like that, but she didn't say it. She said, did anybody ever ask Van Gogh to paint A Starry Night again? And is there a point at which
she's
when people...
tough. I think she's tough. I don't think she suffers fools lightly.
But do you have any of that in you, or is your attitude is that's all who I am, the old, the new, the whatever, and you're totally content when someone says my favorite song X and whatever?
No, that's fine, and I do the old favorites because that's what people came to hear. I mean, they're liking the new stuff as much as the old stuff, but they came to hear the ones they're familiar with.
Yeah.
And my take is that it wouldn't be fair not to do some of those.
So will you play something else for us?
Sure.
What would that be?
Let's do something else off the...
Fine.
The new
Go for
one.
It.
It's called Hack and Sack, and the backstory is that we did the music recording...
Hack and Sack.
On Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. And on Tuesday night, Jim Rooney, the producer, got all upset. He said, wait a minute, we've only got 11 songs. I thought we had 12. I wrote one down twice. And I said, Jim, calm down. I've got it. Here's how we're going to solve the problem. We're going to number the album the way Trump numbers the towers. We're going to have songs 1 through 6 and 8 through 12.
Oh, very
and
good.
And nobody's going to notice.
Do people very know good. That's and, true, that there are not as many floors in Trump
yeah,
Tower
yeah,
as he
says
exactly.
They're all right.
Okay, just
right.
want to make sure people
So,
know.
Anyway, he wouldn't buy it. Jim wouldn't go for it. So I had to go back to the hotel room and write a song that night.
And this is it?
This is it.
Okay.
This is it. And this is the one, actually, that the music disc jockeys are telling me that people are requesting a lot.
Terrific.
And it's a... I just love New Jersey, so please don't get me wrong. There's just one tiny little itty-bitty thing that makes me sing this song. The Garden State is just first rate from Teaneck to Fort Lee. If I never get back to Hackensack, it'll be all right with me. I got nutty friends in Nutley, and they're bonkers in Bayonne. My sidekick's down in Squonkum, they won't let you drink alone.
and they're raucous in Secaucus, and they whip it in Whippany. But if I never get back to Hackensack, it'll be all right with me. I've seen how they rock in Rockaway, I've seen Love Ladies Beaches Bums. P's you pack and P-Pack, well, they're really next to none. Why they let them name it Squonkum, that's sure a mystery. But if I never get back to Hackensack, it'll be all right with me. They got a place called Cheesequake, and that really makes me smile. And another one called Leaktown, I stopped there just a while. Honey's Mill, Manuka Chunk, Plumsock, and Moonakee. But I never get back to Hackensack, it'll be all right with me. It's the light at the end of the tunnel, the Cape May cakes are funnel. It's just one man's opinion, boys, but if you're asking me, if I never get back to Hackensack, I miss that lady like a knife in the back. You'll need a straight jacket to get me back to Hackensack.
Yes, Tom Rush. Tom, it is great to see you.
Poor Hackensack.
As always. I don't know if there are tickets left, but if there are, check out this TCAN thing. Not only is Tom Rush there, who is one of the best.
Go to tomrush.com for all the information you'll ever. Oh, I'm also doing the Guthrie Center out in Great Barrington next weekend, next Friday, Saturday.
Fair enough. Check it all out. Tomrush.com.
Okay,
It's great to see Tom
Rush's latest album is Voices. You can catch him not Thursday, but this Friday and Saturday night, 8 o'clock. The Center for the Arts in Natick. Thank you very much for coming in, talking
Thanks
to us, and playing for us. I really appreciate
Always
it.
A pleasure.
Center for the Arts in Natick, Friday and Saturday, 8 o'clock. Up next, in her latest novel, writer Catlin Moran brings fame down to earth, warts, two-night stands, and all at all. She's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio, live from our WGBH studio at the Boston Public Library.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. We're live from our GBH studio at the Boston Public Library. Catlin Moran's new novel, How to Be Famous, is the sequel to her bestseller, How to Be a Girl. It's part of a coming-of-age trilogy set in London's Britpop scene, where her protagonist takes on a male-dominated industry and the sleazeballs who populate it. Catlin Moran will be at the Brattle Theater tonight at 6 o'clock in conversation with Meredith Goldstein. That is great. An event sponsored by the Harvard Bookstore. Catlin, it's great to see you again.
It's so nice to be back. You are my favorite people that I ever come and talk to when I'm in
America.
And wow. I'm not saying that. Look at the truth in my eyes.
That's unbelievable.
You are genuinely the best.
You don't Speaking say of that your to eyes. All the interviewers. You don't say that to everyone who interviews you.
We're done here now. This is it. That's it. That's all we need to say.
Hear what you just said to me? What are your names again? Why don't you tell people you got here early today? What have you been doing for the last hour?
For the last hour, I had an hour to kill, so I went and got a makeover. I went to the MAC store, and I've had all the makeup in the world put on my face. I now look like a sexy clown, do I not?
I love the lipstick, and I love
right,
the MAC store.
Thank you. I heard all the gossip. There's a guy who goes in there called Ray. He takes his wife in there, but also his mistress, but they think he loves his wife more than his mistress. Drama!
That is a... So I assume the wife does not know that the mistress is in there visiting?
No, but the mistress knows the wife's taken in there, and she always asks for the more expensive stuff.
Who was the president of France who, at his funeral,
Mitterrand,
his mistress and his wife trailed the funeral cortege?
Oh,
you
I
didn't
hear
know
there
that?
Was a queue.
No,
it was
they
like,
were better
it was
than
like
that.
A taxi queue to an airport,
they were next
to
the coffin, and he was going to be lowered 6 feet, and they were right there, and their
thing.
Children that they had. You know, he was the father of both sides there, so they were all there. It was very sophisticated.
It's very French. Let's
so
face it.
Your timing on this, the male dominant industry and the sleazeballs in it, is impeccable. But tell us, you get the How thing going, How to Be Famous. So tell us about that, and then tell us about this new book.
Well, the How to thing is I like writing manuals, whether they're fiction or nonfiction. So How to Be a Woman was nonfiction. The How to Build a Girl was the first in the trilogy. The second one is How to Be Famous, and the last will be How to Change the World. I want to know that a book's going to be useful, and a title will tell you that. I didn't go to school. I was taught at home by my parents, and I spent all my time in a library, which is why it's so great being here. I can't believe you're having a party in a library.
Isn't it wonderful?
Yeah. I feel so at home. And so I learned everything I know from books. And the ideal book, the best books, the books that you're looking for, are ones where the author has put their entire life's experiences in between two covers, and when you read it, it's like you've lived that life. So you've lived two lives, and then you read another great book, and it's like you've lived three lives. So that's the kind of books that I want to write. Ones that tell you how to deal with things.
So is Joanna Morgan you?
Well, I mean, there's a massive legal disclaimer in the front of the book, so...
We saw that.
So the answer is yes.
The answer is yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Describe her. For those who didn't do the first part of the trilogy, now we're in part two.
Well, again,
describe her
to
me. She was 16 then?
Yeah, you have to 15? Imagine something very, very, very legally different to me. So she's a fat working-class girl from Wolverhampton who wants to go on a noble yet entertaining sex quest. She's a writer, she's funny, she talks too fast, and she's definitely legally not me.
Okay. Yeah. but the whole thing with the that kind of coincides with the Me Too movement mm-hmm. is what?
Well, I had the idea for this book 10 years ago as a trilogy. And the plot in this book is that she's going around being a lady swashbuckler and having her amusing sexual times. And she has sex with a hot young comedian, willingly and consensually, although the sex turns out to be quite unpleasant. And then she finds out later on that he has a sex tape of her, and he's going around and showing people this. And so the idea of the book is, what can you do when you are being sexually shamed, when you're being sexually blackmailed, when there are people in the entertainment industry who are more powerful than you, more famous than you, who are going to use their power against you? And the solution that I come up with in the book, which I came up with 10 years ago, I was so thrilled with. I don't want to give it away because it's the big twist. But as I was writing the book, the whole Harvey Weinstein Me Too thing kicked off. And it's such a rare thing in the life of a writer that what you're writing is what is happening in the world right now.
You know, I don't know if I'm reading too much in your facial expression. Do you resent the fact, when you answer that question, I conceived of this 10 years ago. Do you resent the fact that I think a lot of people are concluding there was this Me Too thing, and then Caitlin Moran said, let me hook my wagon to that particular...
Well, I would love to think they think I would be able to conceive and write a novel in under 5 months. If they think I'm that fast, that would be incredible.
But are you okay? It doesn't bother you when you hear that, aren't doing the math?
Well, I mean, the thing that I've always wanted to do when I write a book is start a conversation, like kind of, you know, is to tap into the things that we're not talking about and to in some way change the world. I believe everyone can change the world a little bit. So if I can come along at this time and come up with solutions and talk about these things and tell it as a story, so it's not a news item. You follow someone how they feel. Because at the beginning of it, Johanna doesn't know how to feel about it. She's a woman. She has suppressed her anger. Often when things happen to women that are wrong, we do not feel anger for a long time. It takes us a long time to finally come into our anger and go, no, hang on, that was wrong.
It seems to me that another important theme, I hope I'm right about this, and if I'm wrong, be nice to me anyway.
Oh, well, otherwise be nice to you.
Is that Johanna has help from another woman, that she doesn't sort of deal with this all alone. Is that...
I so wanted to write about female friendship, because it's so often when people write about female friendship, there's a moment where the friends fall out. It has to be a rivalry. It's got to be a queen bee
thing.
What
is it, Suzanne? Is that the...
She's called Suzanne Banks, and she's a singer and a sort of riot girl. She's kind of like a Courtney Love character. She's basically based on Courtney Love.
Whom you've met.
Who I spent a lot of time hanging out with.
Yes.
And Suzanne tells everyone she's 25, but she's actually 32, because that's what you have to do if you're in a rock band. And she's an older feminist mentor who can come along and put names to these things. She can quote to her feminist text that brilliant Audre Lorde quote, your silence will not protect you, is a key thing all the way through this. Women think that by keeping quiet and making ourselves small, not making a fuss, it will protect us. It doesn't. These things will chew you up inside. They will have consequences for your career. You have to learn to talk about it.
We're talking to Caitlin Moran. Her latest is How to Be Famous.
You know, you tell a great story in The Cut, which is a great website, by the way. I love
Thank
that
you.
Website. Tell us about the editor who requested that you sit on his knees.
Yeah,
this
I couldn't believe this.
So I
started being a journalist at the age of 16 because I was taught at home, so I wasn't going to school, so I had time on my hands. I wanted to earn money. And so I started working for Melody Maker, which was a rock magazine in the UK at the time. And, yeah, I'd been there working for about 6 months. I wanted to write a bigger feature, and I went over to one of the editors, I won't say which one, and said I'd really like to do, I think I should do a bigger feature now. And he said, come over here, sit on my lap, let's talk about it. And for 30 seconds, I didn't know what to do because I was a very fat, very ugly girl in a huge pair of glasses. And 6 months ago, I'd been being chased across wasteland by yobs who would be shouting, you fat lesbian, at me
and throwing
rocks at me. So in a way, the fact that I was now being sexually objectified felt like a bit of a promotion. Like, wow, okay, by any kind of metric, things are slightly better for me now. But then it was like, no, but some sexism is happening to me. How do I deal with this? And because I'm the oldest of 8 children, I have a lot of little brothers, I was like, oh, treat him like a little brother. So I just sat down on his lap very heavily and just bounced up and down until he lost the circulation. And then he went, yes, okay, you can have your feature.
But I thought that was an incredible story, that you would have the you-know-whats 18 to treat an older, powerful man that way and to just not do what so many young women do, which is acquiesce?
Well, at that time I was 16, which I think really helped because, I mean, I was still a child. Like, yeah. I absolutely responded to him as a child would. And I think you are, you know, your stupidity does protect you at that age. You have no idea of the consequences. You're just like, this man has just said something rude to me. I will hurt him.
How old were you in the story you told me before when you were interviewing? I think you were pretty young, not 16. When the woman with the bare breasts were behind
I was older. I was about 28 or 30 or something.
But those I bet are, you look 16.
Those were British guys, by the way. I used to work for the Boston Herald, and it was taken over by Rupert Murdoch's. Rupert Murdoch bought it, and they brought in a bunch of British guys to run the paper.
Uh-huh.
And it was pretty shocking, the blatant sexism.
Really?
This would have been, I don't know, like 1985 or 1990 or something like that. The blatant sexism, which you'd see the terrible sexism and the terrible sexual harassment by American men, but the British guys would show up with these big, huge, naked women posters and just kind of put them up in the office, and no one really...
That was amazing. We had a big campaign in the UK, because in the main tabloids that we have there, they have, I guess you have them here, like sort of glamour models. They're on Page Street topless.
Yes, that was those were really big papers, right?
Yeah, and there was a big feminist campaign in the UK to get them removed, which we won in the end, hurrah. But halfway through that, there was a statement put out that explained they only had the topless models in there Monday to Friday. They didn't have them in the paper on Saturday because it was explained that it was to give men at work higher morale. So they didn't need them at the weekend. They don't need them at the weekend. But Monday to Friday, wabs out, ladies. We've got to increase productivity. I couldn't believe it when that was being given as a reason. It was just like, wow. If you're saying that men... they won't work, then how are they ruling the world?
Beautifully
how
put
is this
there,
happening?
Caitlin. Now, can we talk about a related theme? I think was this in New York Magazine when you wrote it? You wrote about Me Too. Is it New York Magazine? I read a piece by you.
Okay. Yes.
So I'm going to put words in your mouth, and then you're going to tell me if I got it wrong. Mm-hmm. You essentially wrote that there is Me Too and there is Me Too. Is that a fair description?
Yeah, basically, yeah.
And when Matt Damon did that shortly after the Harvey Weinstein thing broke, he almost had a career-ending kind of experience, and you're making a face at me. Why?
I don't know the Matt Damon thing.
But he was basically saying there's gradations, which is
Yes, I would agree with that. Well, I mean, the piece that I write about in The Cut, I mean, it's always good to roll these things out over 1,000 words rather than in one sentence, but the Me Too thing was absolutely necessary. But for me, Me Too is about criminal behavior. That is stuff that you can be taken to court with a lawyer and be found to be guilty of sexual assault, rape, criminal acts. Then in the wake of the Me Too, news story breaking, a lot of other women's bad sexual experiences started to be chronicled in things.
Like Aziz Ansari, which we discussed on the show.
Yes, exactly, yeah, and the Cat Person essay.
Cat Person.
Which were necessary conversations for us to have, but they are it's different from a criminal act. These are conversations about basically how the sex education that we have, and particularly younger men now, is all from online pornography. Like, kind of men and women are not having a conversation about what good, you know, sex should be enjoyable. We really seem to have lost sight of this. It should be consensual. It should be conversational. But those sort of the Cat Person one and the Aziz Ansari case seem to be about basically a whole generation just going, we've messed this up. We don't know how to have sex anymore. Animals are managing to do this on shed roofs in the rain, and yet human beings are making what should be very joyful, something that doesn't cost any money and won't make you put on weight. We've really screwed this up.
Did you take lot of heat for that or no?
You know what? It's been amazing. Like it's been retweeted by James Corden retweeted it. Lena Dunham retweeted it. It's been flying. I'm getting like sort of like 200-300 responses from people a day, and everybody apart from a couple of male incels who've got angry about it. But they get angry about everything.
You know, it's interesting though. We had sort of a generational breakdown. We were talking about this, where women like that were over 40 thought this was like, you know, just horrible bad sex, and women that were young, like 20, 25, some of our staff members here were much more upset about this and saw this differently than like I did.
Yes.
And I wondered about that.
Well, I've noticed this thing. I've written about this because there are a lot of women of my generation and older who, when we started talking about sexual harassment in the workplace, went, well, I went through all these, you know, terrible experiences in sexual harassment and stuff, and it did me no harm, and I've survived, and younger people just need to shut up.
Right.
And I wrote a piece going, well, first of all, the fact that you have no sympathy suggests that you were probably emotionally damaged by this, and the fact that you have managed to stay in your job in order to be able to write columns about this or broadcast this opinion neglects the fact that all the women who couldn't cope with this and were really upset about this or felt they were handed out of the workplace don't have columns and aren't on the radio anymore because they just simply had to leave. Luckily, we have the kind of personalities we can deal with this, but the people who can't leave. And again,
that's a great point.
And again, I sort of, you know, I frame all this now because my daughters are now 17 and 14.
Oh,
and what their idea of sex must be like and what male and female relationships are like and what courtship is like, it gives me terror. that they would think that, you know, the stuff that you click a button, the stuff that you're seeing, I don't want my little girls to be thinking that's what it's like. I want them to find a nice boy, like kind of, I was going to say like their dad, but that sounds really wrong, but kind of like a lovely cardigan-wearing man who's just all gentle and kind, and he's just like, this should be fun, not some kind of weird, horrible Olympic sport that everybody ends up feeling sour and unhappy.
Catalin Moran, you willing to read a little bit from your book for us?
I am willing to read a little bit, always, yes.
Excellent, we love that.
So, in the book, which is in no way based on my life.
No, not at all.
In no way, shape, or form, the character, Johanna Morrigan, hooks up with a young, sexy rock and roll comedian who's called Jerry Sharp, who is based on no English comedians that have ever existed. I need to make that perfectly clear. Revenge is sweet. In later years, when I'm having a long lunch with some girlfriends and we take it in turns to talk about the worst men in the world, they come up with a list of things that, if you see them in a man's apartment, should tip you off that you are in the presence of a bad man. As they point out whilst drinking wine and howling, Jerry Sharp's apartment had the full set. A framed John Coltrane poster. A framed Betty Blue poster. A bookshelf filled with Hunter S. Thompson, Nietzsche, Jack Kerouac, Henry Miller, and books about the Third Reich. Nazis is always a no, isn't it? Let's face it. Several hats, a velvet frock coat. The complete works of both The Fall and Frank Zappa, a pile of pornography, a bottle of absinthe, and a coffee table with noticeable scratch lines from chopping out cocaine. Any woman, when she sees those things, must run, they concluded, laughing and crying at the same time, because this is clearly the house of a man who hates women. And they were correct. However, at the time, I was still only 18 and I had yet to learn this, so I just thought, cool, he's an edgy intellectual. The whole
That's
book
great.
Is basically explaining why you must never go for an edgy intellectual or the kind of man that would write poetry or wear a velvet frock coat. You've got to look for the good men and the nice men and learn how to identify them. This is the advice I wanted at the age of 17.
So let's talk about a little bit about current events. Mm-hmm. The President of the United States is coming to, going, I should say, to London soon.
Yes.
You're planning to do what?
I'm going straight off the plane. I land at Heathrow at 9 o'clock. My husband's meeting me in the car. I'm putting my suitcase in the back, and we're going straight on a march.
That's not true. Is that
with
really
your
true?
Kids? Oh God, absolutely. Yeah. No. We've arranged the whole thing. I'm meeting up with about 50 friends. People I know who have never gone on a march before are going on this march. It's going to be. I think it's going to be the biggest march that we've had in Britain in 50 years.
And why? Why are people in Britain incensed about President Trump?
Well, I mean, I don't know if you guys have noticed over here, but we notice over in the UK he doesn't seem to be a terribly pleasant person. So we're hoping that by marching around a bit, people might notice this. It's around about the time you start putting children in cages, we're kind of like that seems impolite.
Yeah.
You know, we were talking to Juliette Kayyem before, Homeland Security person and regular on our show, about the fact that the American embassy has put out a warning to Americans in Great Britain that at the time of Trump's visit, don't go out of your way, and this is euphemistic, don't go out of your way to make it clear that you are an American.
Yes.
What do you make of that?
I think that's an astonishingly Trumpian twist. We are very clear in the UK that any British people who will be living in America will almost certainly be joining us on that march, and we will be holding hands with them. Like, kind of, I thought that was another one of those things where it's just the twisting of the news, just kind of like, Americans, you are now under threat because of this march. Who's going to be under threat from British people marching?
Have
you seen us? We've got terrible policy.
Do the Brits blame what the worst of Trump in their estimation on us? We've told the story a million times. I was in France when George W. Bush was president, and no one would speak to you.
Yeah.
And then I was in France when Barack Obama was president, and everybody would speak to you, almost as if I was Barack Obama or his campaign manager, George Bush's.
Are we
Donald Trump, whether we supported him or not?
I don't know. I mean, the American ambassador in London gave an amazing interview to the Evening Standard newspaper yesterday, just basically apologizing for nearly everything that Donald Trump had said.
Really?
Yeah. She was having, you know, phrases that he's used about kind of grabbing ladies and all this kind of stuff. She was having to say, you know, you mustn't believe everything he said. He says he kind of tends to exaggerate. This is not the kind of thing that I would say. They're having to put like huge concrete fences around the American embassy because he's staying there on Thursday night.
Well, speaking of grabbing ladies, you know, there's a weird dynamic. You went through this in Great Britain where there were all these Irish women that were flying into Great Britain to have abortions because Ireland had made them illegal, and the voters just threw that out. Now they are legal, at least up to 12 weeks. And here we are in the United States facing going backwards, you know, 40 years or 45 years or whatever it is, to when Roe v. Wade was first legalized. That's a weird situation.
Well, there are two things to realize. Like, if you read enough history, it will stop you having a heart attack with the way that things are, particularly in the Western world at the moment politically. We went through a period after the Second World War of building things, of constructing things, of uniting continents, you know, sort of like, you know, fortifying democracy, spreading democracy, inventing, in our case, the welfare state, the NHS, etc. And then we're going through a period of destruction now. Things are being torn apart. We are going backwards. The clock's being reset, both on the left and on the right, in our country at least. It's all about going back to a certain period of time, kind of, you know, going back to making things great as they used to be. But this is cyclical. History is cyclical. So this is the bad phase at the moment. At some point, we'll start building things and moving forward again. So it's really important to read your history books and not get scared about these things, but also to learn from the campaigns. I was very closely involved in the repeal campaign in Ireland, and it was not so much a top-down from a city, people writing blogs and broadcasting it, and kind of, you know, elites, metropolitan elites, telling the Irish how to vote. It was an educational on-the-ground campaign. For instance, there was a woman who ran a chain of nail bars across Ireland, and she came to the repeal campaigners and said, "Look, feminism always seems so middle-class to me. How can I, as a working-class woman, get involved?" And she had T-shirts made up with "Repeal, ask me about it," gave them to all of her nail technicians, and everyone who came in for a manicure or a pedicure would go, "Okay, tell me, educate me about the abortion laws in this country. How should I vote?" It was like a proper from the ground up campaign.
Oh, I love that.
And, you know, for anybody who feels that they're despairing about politics at the moment, there is so much to learn from that repeal campaign. They managed to identify and stop all the Facebook advertising and political funding that was going through there. It's the first election in the Anglophone world where that has been identified and stopped. It was a landslide victory. It was educative. It was across all classes. And, you know, I hope with Brexit in the UK and with Trump over here, if that's the way your politics tend to slide, there's a lot to learn from the repeal girls in Ireland.
We're talking with Catelyn Moore, and her new book is How to Be Famous. You know, you mentioned before that you'd love to read autobiographies because it's like living a second life.
Yes.
Now, of course, we know your book is not an autobiography.
Absolutely
but,
not.
But,
let's
but,
make that clear.
But tell us, who's a couple of your favorite autobiographers? I'd love to know whom you...
I can remember reading Harpo Marx's autobiography when I was 11, and that blew my mind. Harpo Marx and the Marx Brothers, not least because it had words in it. Obviously, he's a silent performer. But he wrote about he was a member of the Algonquin Round Table, so he was friends with Dorothy Parker. So that was how I learned about all these, you know, it's the first time I'd heard about a funny woman. I was like, Harpo's friend, she sounds amazing. Learned about Dorothy Parker. Spike Milligan, who's a member of the Goons, sort of a very influential kind of Dadaist comedian. His war memoirs from the Second World War are absolutely incredible. I've learned, even an awfully written autobiography will teach you something. Oh, I love David Niven's autobiographies as well.
Really?
So gossipy and funny, they're amazing.
Great. They
are, absolutely. I love a gossipy one. But then there's an amazing one called Food in England by Dorothy Hartley, where she talks about that she worked as a cook in a monastery, then she worked in a boarding school, she worked in a farm, so she's worked everywhere in the UK cooking with these amazing recipes and telling the history.
You know, speaking of cooking, I just realized I've been talking to a lot of
British
people
baking
saying...
Show?
Exactly. For those of us who are ready to explode every day,
yes.
We've all started watching The Great British Baking Show.
Oh, I'm
do you
so
love it
glad.
As much as we do?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, my God.
Yes, no, it's our favourite. Well, I mean, the bad news is that we don't have it anymore in the UK, so your pipeline's going to be running out quite soon. It got taken over. We've got different presenters now. So enjoy what you've got.
And do people, are they into it for the same reason, beyond the fact that it is so campy and great? It is so settling in an unsettled time.
Yes,
it's unbelievable.
And it kind of doesn't matter who wins or who loses.
Exactly.
Everybody's just happy to be making
They're all
cake.
Hugging each
yes.
other and baking. I
yeah.
love it. I'm
did
so
it
glad
get,
you did, feel
are
it.
There new presenters because the ratings weren't good? Or
No. It got bought by another channel and they brought in new presenters. I nearly segued into something. Okay, there's a secret I can't give away, but it kind of links to The Great British Bake Off. I started shooting the film of How to Build a Girl this week.
Oh, yes.
And we've got some amazing guest actors and performers in it doing cameos.
Who are they?
Which is true. That was why I just suddenly realised I can't say.
Exactly.
But they're all amazing people. So okay. Beanie Feldstein, who was in Lady Bird, is playing Johanna Morrigan. And we've got Alfie Allen from Game of Thrones playing the rock star. And
you
it's
look really
very
happy.
Excited.
You
I'm making
be.
A film.
Catelyn Moran, it's great to see you. Again.
Yeah,
pleasure.
Thank you very much
anytime.
For coming in. It was really fun, as it always is. Catelyn Moran's new book is How to Be Famous, a sequel to her bestseller, How to Build a Girl, part of a coming-of-age trilogy set in London's Britpop scene. This is the intro, not the exit.
Yeah. We know who she is. What's the name of the book, and where's she going to be tonight
at
6 o'clock?
She's going to be at 6 o'clock in conversation with Meredith Goldstein at the Harvard Bookstore. To get tickets, go to harvard.com. Catlin, thank you so much for
thank
coming
you
in.
Guys.
Thank
you, Catlin. So nice
Jim
to
Brady,
back.
Tell us quickly what's on TV.
I'm going to be joined by a couple whose 18-year-old daughter was killed by a distracted driver. They're leading a nationwide campaign, including at our state house, to end handheld phones. There's a big rally as we speak, and they'll join me tonight.
I want to make sure I said it was the Brattle Theater tonight at 6 o'clock with Meredith Goldstein from The Globe. Okay. Thank you very much. I'm Marjorie Egan. Thank you very much.
Thank you all for coming.
We
forgot that part.
Really appreciate it.
We're a little disorganized.
We are disorganized.
I am Jim Browdy, though. I know that.
That's right. Thank you very much
for
tuning in. Please tune again tomorrow and have a wonderful afternoon.